Now 6:30.
Well, good evening and welcome everyone to the regular meeting of the Santa Clarita Valley Water Agency Board of Directors for October 19th, 2021. And with that, I'd like to call the meeting to order and ask Director Cooper if he would recite the pledge for us. And all the rest of us, please either mute yourself or say it to you silently to yourself. Director Cooper, please proceed.
Thank you. Ready? Begin. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you, Director Cooper. Before we move on to item three, I have our regular set of announcements to make tonight. This meeting is being conducted pursuant to the provisions of AB 361 and SCV Water Resolution SCV-235. Board and staff, please mute all of your devices until you are ready to speak. To avoid feedback, echoing, and background noise, make sure you unmute when speaking and remute when you are done speaking. All board members, please turn on your cameras during the meeting. Staff, please turn on your cameras when speaking and turn them off when you are done speaking. Board members will be advised to use the raise hand feature in Zoom when action and discussion items are presented. I will call on each of you when it is your turn to speak. Members of the public may comment as to items within the subject matter jurisdiction of the agency that are not on the agenda during item three. Members of the public wishing to comment on items covered in this agenda may do so at the time each item is considered. To participate in public comment from your computer, tablet, or smartphone, when I announce the agenda item you wish to speak on, click the raise hand feature in Zoom. You will be notified when it is your turn to speak. Please unmute when requested. Please do not turn on your camera unless you are speaking during public comment, and then please turn them off when you have completed your comments. To participate in public comment via phone, when I announce the agenda item you wish to speak on, dial *9 to raise your hand. Phone participants will be called upon by the last two digits of their phone number or by name. When it is your turn to speak, dial *6 to unmute. When you are finished with your public comment, staff will re-mute you. Please be familiar with the last two digits of your phone number. In an attempt to help the flow of the meeting and alleviate confusion, we have changed the procedure for approving items and taking public comments. I will introduce each agenda item. Staff will present. I will ask for public comments. I will then ask for discussion and questions from board members. Please use the raise hand feature. Once concluded, I will ask for a motion and a second. After any further discussion, the board secretary will call the roll for votes. Any PowerPoint shown at tonight's meeting are posted to the SCV Water website. The board secretary will be doing attendance by roll call, and each item being considered will be taken by roll call vote. We have some students from the College of the Canyon, members of the Engage the Vote group. They hosted a meet and greet with the SCV Water Board candidates last year and are joining our board tonight to see us in action and to get some experience attending local government board meetings. Welcome to our College of the Canyon students who are joining us tonight. Madam Secretary, will you please call the roll for attendance?
Director Kelly, are you present? I'll come back to Director Kelly. Director Armitage, are you present?
Present.
Director Cooper, are you present?
Present.
Director Ford, are you present?
Present.
Director Bronstein, are you present?
Present.
Director Orserhofsky, are you present?
Present.
Director Colley, are you present?
I'm here.
Director Plambeck, are you present?
Yes, I'm here.
Director Atkins, are you present?
Present.
Director Kelly, are you present? I see that he is connecting. I'll come back to him. Vice President Gladbach, are you present?
Yes.
Vice President Mortensen, are you present?
Present.
President Martin, are you present?
I am present.
And one more time, Director Kelly, are you present? I see you, so I see that you're present.
I'm present. Thank you.
Thank you. Back to you, President Martin.
Thank you, April. We will now continue on to item three, public comment. Members of the public may comment as to items within the subject matter jurisdiction of the agency that are not on the agenda at this time. We ask that members of the public wishing to comment on items covered in this agenda do so at the time each item is considered. Members of the public wishing to comment on items covered in closed session. However, we are not going to have a closed session, so I will not make that announcement. We have one written submitted public comment from Mr. Steve Petzold, who also will speak on it tonight. The handout for his comment is posted on the SCV Water website, and the link was sent out. Madam Secretary, do we have any members of the public who would like to comment at this time?
We do. Mr. Petzold, go ahead. You can please begin your public comment.
Good evening. Tonight, I wanted to talk to you about relocation of the disc golf course at Central Park. Well, I know that's not part of your general business. The back course is being removed in order that the city can put in four multi-field softball field areas. So what the city has proposed is moving the nine baskets that are in the back area up towards the front area. As you may or may not know, many of the baskets involved in disc golf are adjacent to the fence, which is on the north and northeast perimeter of the area. The proposal by the city, we don't feel it accommodates the needs of the disc golf community here in Santa Clarita. So I'd like to ask you to place on a future agenda a discussion about moving the fence, which is defines the perimeter between the road leading up to SCV Water and Central Park, so that disc golf could be expanded in that area. I have provided some pictures to you of the area, which could be opened up. And that would give disc golfers more distance, range, and a variable topography, which we would like to have very much. So I know this is a rather complex issue since it does involve moving a fence and involving several different agencies, the City of Santa Clarita and SCV Water. I speak for myself tonight. I haven't spoken in any detail at all to the city, although at the Parks Commission, I did make a recommendation that we considered that to be a possibility. So I would ask you to please put that on the agenda so that we can have a discussion about the pros and cons. It's clear that SCV Water has an abundance of land, and freeing up this area for a disc golf addition, modification, would be very much appreciated, and it's frequently used by the community. So thank you very much, and I appreciate your consideration.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Petzold, for your comment. We will take your comment and your request under consideration. Go ahead, April.
Thank you. Ms. Dunn, please hit star six, and you may begin your public comment. Ms. Dunn?
Yes, good evening. As I said last meeting, that I did not think it was a good idea to allow the public to speak at the very first of each agenda item, because oftentimes in the discussion with the directors, other things come up. And so if the public can talk after the discussion, they have a chance to be involved in the discussion and bring up other items that maybe the directors didn't think about. So I am definitely against this new idea of having the public speak first. I do not like that idea, because I think you are squeezing us out of your meeting. And so that is my thoughts on this, and I hope that the directors actually think about this, because oftentimes, I know even at City Council, way into the night, they had an issue that got resolved because the public brought it up. And so I think that this is very important for the public to be involved. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Dunn. Is there any further public comment? There's no further public comment. President Morton, back to you.
Thank you, April. And in response to Ms. Dunn, I'll take your request again under consideration. Think about it again. To clarify, we did this because we under no circumstances will have the board discussion before public comment. We do have questions on the presentation and questions of staff before. We used to have that before public comment, and we tended to bleed over into open discussion, which I didn't want to do. So we tried moving both after public comment, but I'll think about your request and we'll perhaps try that again and try to keep us from going into public discussion as opposed to question and answer. So thank you, Ms. Dunn, for that. And with that, we can move on to item 4, approval of the agenda. I would entertain a motion for approval of the agenda.
Gary?
Yes.
I was hoping that I could make a comment.
Director Conley.
Is that all right?
Yes, go ahead.
The little hands are sometimes hard to see here.
Yes.
So as part of Ms. Dunn's comment, I want to stress to her and to the public that the way we're currently formatted is appropriate because I specifically want to hear from the public as I am working to form an opinion. And if we do a board discussion first and essentially then have kind of completed our debate or our thoughts, and then and only then do we listen to their constituents, that doesn't make any sense to me. I want to listen to my constituents ahead of forming my opinion and making whatever arguments that I might want to make on an issue. So quite the opposite of squeezing the public out by allowing the public to speak to us before we begin to consider and debate, but after the staff has provided all the information that is needed by both us and the public in order to form an opinion. I think we do have the appropriate model right now. So quite the opposite of intending to squeeze her out. I think that this is the most inclusive way of providing public participation. So I appreciate it. Thank you.
Excuse me. I wasn't sure why you were raising your hand, so I didn't interrupt you before, but it's not appropriate to be commenting or stating your position unless the matter is on the agenda.
Very good. Okay. Thank you. It's inappropriate for me to provide a comment, a brief comment on a public comment. Is that, never understood that.
Not in that sense, no. You can ask the public member questions. You can ask that something be directed to committee, but not engage in debate.
Okay, well, I certainly didn't intend to engage in debate. I provided what I thought was a brief response to a public comment, which I thought was very specifically allowed under the Brown Act. If I'm wrong, I appreciate if you could send me some kind of a citation to explain why a brief response to public comment is not appropriate from the board. Thank you.
Thank you, Director Colley. Thank you, Mr. Bunn, for your input on that. We are back to the agenda. We are back to item 4. Again, I would entertain a motion for approval of the agenda. Do I have?
So moved, Atkins.
Motion by Director Atkins.
Jerry seconds.
Second by Vice President Gladback. Are there any questions before I ask for public comment and the vote? Hearing no questions, Madam Secretary, do we have any public comment on this before we call for the vote?
We do not.
Very good. With that, we have a motion and a second. Please call the roll for the vote.
Director Ozuchowski, how do you vote?
Yes.
Director Plambeck, how do you vote?
Yes.
Director Cooper, how do you vote?
Yes.
Director Ford, how do you vote?
Yes.
Director Cawley, how do you vote?
Yes.
Director Bronstein, how do you vote?
Yes.
Director Armitage, how do you vote?
Yes.
Director Atkins, how do you vote?
Yes.
Director Kelly, how do you vote?
Yes.
Vice President Mortensen, how do you vote?
Yes.
Vice President Gladbeck, how do you vote?
Yes.
President Martin, how do you vote?
Yes.
The agenda is approved.
Very good. Thank you, April. Thank you, directors. We move on to item 5, special procedures. We are fortunate tonight to have some special guests with us to make a very important presentation. The presentation is on the Delta Conveyance Design and Construction Authority, and we have with us the DCA Executive Director, Graham Bradner, and the Department of Water Resources Environmental Manager, Carrie Buckman. The presentation will be about 30 to 40 minutes. There will not be any Q&A during the presentation. We are asking the board to hold their comments and questions until after the presentation has concluded. Once the presentation has concluded, we will take public comment and then move to board Q&A. With that, I'd like to introduce our guest tonight, Graham Bradner, who is currently the Executive Director of the DCA, Design and Construction Authority. He has 20 years of experience in the evaluation, design, and construction of water supply infrastructure and retrofit of existing levees and dams in Northern California. Graham is a professional geologist in the state of California and a state-certified engineering geologist and hydrogeologist. His broad experience and skills were developed through working with and leading large multidiscipline water infrastructure projects, ranging from screening studies and feasibility studies through the development of detailed designs and packages for bidding and construction. Before joining the DCA, Graham managed the Sacramento Engineering Division of GEI Consultants Incorporated and served on the corporate board of directors. Graham joined the DCA in 2019 and was the lead for four bays and levees, siting studies, and program-wide evaluations. He also served as deputy to the engineering design manager and was responsible for coordinating design efforts for various components of the project. Graham received his Bachelor of Science degree in Environmental Geology and a Master's of Science degree in Hydrogeology, both from Clemson University. That's too bad. He should have gone to Maryland. He's also an avid ski junkie who enjoys taking advantage of world-class skiing in his backyard, which happens to be Lake Tahoe, as much as possible. With that, please welcome Graham Bradner, and I will move on to the introduction of our other special guest tonight, Carrie Buckman. Carrie Buckman is DWR's Environmental Program Manager for Delta Conveyance, responsible for environmental planning and permitting for a potential single tunnel conveyance project. Prior to working for DWR, Carrie was in the private sector for 21 years working on feasibility studies and environmental compliance for large water and restoration projects. She worked on planning efforts for Yolo Bypass Fisheries Restoration and the San Joaquin River Restoration Program and long-term water transfers. And thank you both for joining us tonight. And at this point, I'm going to pass it on to Dirk Marks, who is our Director of Water Resources, to provide a brief introduction to the project before we turn it over to you for your presentation. Mr. Marks, would you please proceed?
You're muted, Dirk.
Mr. Marks, are you there?
Yeah. Looks like it might just be one of those situations where you have to reset your microphone in Zoom. It's usually by the up caret over by the mute button.
Does this work now?
There you are. There you are.
Okay, quick.
All right. Go ahead. Take it away. Thanks.
Yeah. Yeah, yes. Like I said, we're very fortunate to have Graham and Carrie here tonight to provide information and updates on the Delta Conveyance Project. Tonight, I just wanted to introduce the topic, provide a little bit of background on past efforts to move forward Delta Conveyance for the state project, and also review recent actions that the board has taken in these efforts. Next slide, April. And next slide. So the State Water Project was authorized in 1960s when voters approved the Burns-Porter Act. State Water Projects facilities that were authorized under that act included Delta facilities, which were incorporated into our State Water Project contract. In the late 70s, early 80s, DWR was working on a Delta conveyance facility called the Peripheral Canal that had a capacity of 21,000 acre feet. As the name implies, it went around the periphery of the Delta. Water was released from that canal into the Delta for environmental flows, and water also flowed to the State Water Project and Central Valley Project pumping plants in the South Delta. As many of you are familiar, the Delta or the Peripheral Canal was part of SB 200, which contained the Peripheral Canal and a number of other water management facilities that was the subject of Proposition 9, which was not passed by the electorate in June of 1982. After that, the Department of Water Resources focused its efforts on advancing conveyance through the Delta through a number of proposed channel widening and deepening efforts. Ultimately, that effort too was abandoned. In the early 2000s, we had the B-Delta Conservation Plan, and from that BDCP came a what was referred to as the Delta Habitat Conservation and Conveyance Plan. And originally that was designed to provide a habitat conservation plan similar to that had been achieved on the Colorado River, which provided certainty for the contractors as far as how the facility would be operated, along with establishment of significant areas of habitat that designed to improve the habitat in the Delta beyond what was or what it is today. It became apparent that the regulatory agencies ultimately couldn't get there as far as being able to commit to an operations for the project, and the project was transformed more to the California Water Fix, which took a more traditional approach to environmental permitting, including an approach of getting interim take permits for endangered species. That project had an environmental document prepared and finalized, but with change in administration, newly elected Governor Newsom, consistent with his campaign promises, refocus the state's efforts onto a Delta conveyance facility with a design of capacity for the preferred project at 6,000 CFS. So as we move time through time, you can see a progression of a smaller and more focused projects. Next slide, April. So in July of 2018, the agency approved participation in the California Water Fixed, authorized executing contract amendment, and we joined the joint financing, joint powers authority for that project. As I said, Governor Newsom shifted directions for state planning on a Delta conveyance project in January. DWR released a notice of preparation for an EIR for that single tunnel project. During this time, the DWR and the state water contractors of public water agencies were in negotiations with DWR to and completed an agreement in principles for a contract amendment providing for the proposed project. In November of 2020, we informed DWR that on a preliminary basis, we desired to participate at a 2.6% level. That's 2.6% of the 6,000 CFS. We executed an agreement to provide for planning cost, and we joined the Design and Construction Authority. So that kind of brings you up to date with respect to agency actions. Eventually a thumbnail sketch, but I need to give you that background and orientation. With that, I'll pass it on to Graham.
Thank you, Dirk, for your presentation. Before I hand it back off to Graham, I want to say I was just kidding about Clemson University. It's a fine university for a football school, by the way. So go ahead, Graham. Please proceed.
Thank you for the clarification, President Martin. and thank you, Dirk, for setting the information out there and getting us teed up. So good evening, everyone, and thank you for the opportunity to provide this update on the Delta Conveyance Project. Next slide, please, April. So Carrie and I will be tag teaming this a bit. We're going to cover three main topics. First, Carrie will start us off with an introduction as to why the Delta Conveyance Project is needed, what the benefits will provide to the State Water Project, and then also an overview of the various agency roles and responsibilities for the program. Following that introduction, I'll provide an update on the conceptual design of the project, which is the basis for the impact analyses being performed by the environmental team, including a summary of feedback provided through the stakeholder engagement process and how it's been incorporated into the conceptual designs. And then for the third item, Terry will then provide an overview and update of the planning and permitting process to bring everyone up to speed. Next slide, please. So go ahead, Carrie, take it away.
Thanks. Thank you, President Martin and board members for having us tonight. And I guess I'd like to start by saying, while I didn't go to Maryland, I am from Maryland, so maybe that gets me a little bit of credit. Onto the slides. You know, this year has been a really rough water year for the state. And we've really learned a lot about, I think, what's coming in our future. And what we're seeing is the new normal really does reinforce our need to consider a project like Delta Conveyance So while there's a lot of different potential forecasts for what could happen with climate change and sea level rise, there is some agreement around some trends that are likely coming. We're likely to see less snow and more precipitation falling as rain, and that rain is likely to come over shorter periods and have a less predictable duration. We're also expecting more frequent and extreme drought and flood cycles. So like we've seen in the past few years, more extreme droughts coupled with more extreme flood conditions. And that really does lead to the conditions that we're trying to work with our project, where we're trying to capture water when it's available to potentially store for later use in drought. And adding diversions and creating flexibility promotes a more resilient and flexible state water project in the face of unstable future conditions. And I did want to add that we sort of saw some of this in practice this year. So last year and this year, the state water project really wasn't diverting much water from the Delta except for health and safety deliveries. And so the small amounts of water that the state water project was able to deliver were really associated with deliveries made in 18-19 or diversions from 18 and 19. So that kind of pattern where you divert the water and store it when it's available and use it for supplies during those drought years are going to be really critical as we face more extreme conditions in the future. Next slide, please. And I also wanted to highlight the importance of the state water project water. 3 out of 5 Californians depend on water that flows through the Delta. And the state water project provides a really critical supply. So it provides water to 27 million people, millions of people who are in disadvantaged communities that depend on the state water project as an affordable water supply. 750,000 acres of farmland are irrigated with SWP water, and that works towards the $5 trillion in California economy that is sustained by this water. Next slide, please. So as we look at these risks, that leads to the reasons that we're considering the Delta Conveyance Project. So our purpose in considering this project are to modernize the aging SWP infrastructure in the Delta to restore and protect the reliability of SWP water deliveries in a cost-effective manner, consistent with the state's water resilience portfolio. So we want to protect the state water project in the face of a lot of challenges, which are reflected in our objectives. So we want to address sea level rise and climate change, minimize water supply disruption due to seismic risk, protect water supply reliability, and provide operational flexibility to improve aquatic conditions. Next slide, please. And before we launch into the rest of the presentation, I did want to just give a little bit of discussion about the relationship with DWR and the DCA and also the public water agencies that could receive water from the project. So I am here from DWR, and DWR, we are leading the environmental process. So that includes review under the California Environmental Quality Act, or CEQA. We're leading public outreach and engagement. We are ensuring transparency in the process. We're responsible for planning the planning budget and schedule, and we have to report to the state legislature and others. And also, we direct and oversee the work of the Delta Conveyance Design and Construction Authority, or the DCA. And Graham is the executive director of the DCA. So for the DCA, under the oversight of DWR, the DCA conducts engineering and design work to inform the environmental review, identifies potential engineering and design strategies to avoid or minimize effects, assists in conducting public outreach, public participation, and stakeholder engagement. And the board of directors is comprised of PWA representatives, including President Martin. And the PWAs, in addition to being involved through the DCA Board of Directors, are also helping throughout the process as part of the environmental process as well to provide technical expertise to DWR and the DCA, collaborate on and contribute to public participation and public outreach, and really importantly, ensuring that planning and project development meet the financial, policy, technical, and long-term planning needs of their retailers, member agencies, and ratepayers. Next slide, please. And we are back to Graham.
Okay, perfect. Thank you, Carrie. So go ahead and advance to the next slide, please. So we'll launch into the engineering update now. So our work started with notice of preparation, which identified the central and eastern corridors for the project. Later, the Bethany Reservoir alternative was added during the scoping period. The corridors included intake diversions in the north, some sort of connection to the existing facilities in the south, and then provided broad swaths through the central and eastern delta to be considered in developing the conceptual alignments. The figure on the right shows the three potential alignments. So you can see central corridor, central alignment running through sort of the central part of the delta there on the left side of the image. The eastern alignment running across the eastern side, it hugs a bit closer to the margins of the delta. And then the Bethany Reservoir alternative, which really resembles eastern until you get down to where the orange line starts at Lower Roberts Island, and then it takes a different path down from there to the Bethany Reservoir. So just as a reminder, only one of these alignments would potentially be constructed, and I will go through each of these in a bit more detail in the following slides. But all of our conceptual engineering work will be summarized in the EIR as part of two main engineering project reports, one report for the central and eastern corridors, and then a second supplemental report for the Bethany Reservoir alternative. And then also another clarification, we often talk about the potential project at the 6,000 cubic foot per second capacity, but the EIR is also evaluating the various environmental impacts of potential projects ranging between 3,000 CFS up to 7,500 CFS. Next slide, please. So the conceptual design of the various project alternatives was completed for the major facilities as shown on the graphic. So we just broke these out broadly into categories of intakes, tunnels and shafts, pumping plants, forebays and levees, hydraulic structures, access and logistics, and utilities. Now, key considerations are shown on the right side. These were key in the development of the conceptual designs. So they begin, you know, just kind of rattling through the list there, facility siting, geotechnical conditions, also the conditions of and need for roads, bridges, additional rail connections. We performed a system-wide soil balance, looking to really be efficient within the program in terms of how we use and generate material. Reusable tunnel material also required quite a bit of assessment and evaluation. Think about how we might best make use of that and what long-term storage opportunities would look like. Flood risk reduction is certainly key for conditions in the Delta. I'm sure you're all aware there's over 1,000 miles of levees in the Delta, many of which could be affected by or could affect the construction of such a facility. Thinking about on-site batch plants for concrete was another key factor that we thought about. Some of the difficult sites, or there are a lot of challenging access and logistical requirements. Many of them really couldn't handle bringing concrete from existing batch plants. So we had to look at creating on-site batch plants to feed various parts of the project. Power and water was a very big consideration for the program. The tunnel boring machines themselves have pretty high temporary power demands, and then there's the permanent power for the various elements of the facility. And then the SCADA, which is all of the SCADA and communications, and so that's the telemetry and communications within the system, also a key factor when considering what types of appurtenant facilities would be needed, and also what the overall footprint of the project would need to look like. So the conceptual designs have been used to generate material quantities and equipment lists that are now the basis for the impact analyses being performed underneath Carrie's leadership. The work is still ongoing and is iterative, hence the double-headed arrows there. As the environmental team advances the impact analyses, they come back to the engineering team at the DCA. We explore potential adjustments to the project that may reduce or alter the impacts that they're analyzing through the EIR. So it's a ongoing process that continues now as we just work our way through the various analyses. Next slide, please. So now we'll review each of the alignments at a high level, just one slide per alignment. So I realize there's a lot of information in here, but we'll try and keep it high level from an engineering perspective. A couple of statements that would apply to the three slides that are coming, this one and the next two. The layout assumes 6,000 CFS configuration. So that's two intakes in the north at 3,000 CFS each. Those would be on the left bank of the Sacramento River. And then on the image on the right shows the overall layout of the central alignment, which follows a route through the central delta from the northern intakes down to the connection points at the existing infrastructure in the south delta. The tunnel boring machine launch locations are noted with green arrows. Recept on the right side there. So you see the green arrows at the launch locations. Red arrows note the reception locations where the tunnel boring machine would be received and lifted out of the ground, deconstructed and lifted out of the ground. Central alignment has a total of 42.9 miles of tunneling. That's the shortest of the three alternatives. The launch shafts that I mentioned, you can see them with the green arrows. There would be a total of three launch locations. That's a double launch shaft up at Twin Cities, and then two single launch shafts at Bolden Island, and then another one down at the Southern Complex. There would be a total of three maintenance shafts and then three reception shafts also constructed for the total length of the main tunnel. The connections at the southern end that I'm talking about refer to the connections to the California Aqueduct. So for this configuration, that connection would be through a new pumping plant to lift the water out of the tunnel and into a new above grade reservoir called the Southern Forebay. So you can see that label down there kind of on the bottom. It's just to the west side of existing Clifton Court Forebay. Water would flow by gravity through a set of parallel tunnels connecting at the downstream end of the Southern Forebay to the existing approach channel for the Harvey O. Banks pumping plant. Then the existing Banks pumping plant would lift the water up to Bethany Reservoir, which is the head of the existing canal system, delivering water to points downstream. There would, just as a note, for 7,500 CFS, there would be an additional connection point from just down there at the bottom at the California Aqueduct. There would be an additional tunnel connection over to the Central Valley Project, the federal project. And again, that would deliver water into the approach channel for the Bill Jones pumping plant. And that would be lifted into the CVP canal. Next slide, please. So for the eastern alignment, uses the same northern intake facilities and the same south delta connection. So all of the intake configuration at the north, the Southern Forebay pumping plant connections to existing infrastructure, all of that would be the same. But the difference really falls in the alignment that the tunnel would take to get there. So it follows a more easterly route that's along the eastern margin of the delta, just to the west side of Interstate 5, if you're familiar with Interstate 5 between Stockton and Sacramento. This alignment does result in the longest overall tunneling distance at 45.6 miles, but does have some distinct advantages from a logistics and access perspective. Many of the islands within the interior of the Delta are very difficult to access and would have a very difficult time constructing or supporting a construction project of this magnitude. Also, geotechnical conditions along the eastern side of the Delta are generally on the better side compared to conditions in the central. Next slide, please. The Bethany Reservoir alignment is quite different from the previous two, although it does use the same northern facilities as central and eastern. So again, the same intakes, but from that point down, it's got a lot of differences within. It still has the Twin Cities double launch site, but it looks quite different when you get into the details. From that point, it follows the eastern alignment down to Lower Roberts Island, where it takes a more easterly route to a new pumping plant and pipeline aqueduct system that would deliver water directly to Bethany Reservoir rather than using the existing Banks pumping plant. So we refer to that collection of southern elements there as the Bethany Complex. And so you might hear that later in the presentation, but that's on the bottom of the slide there, the reception shaft, surge basin, pumping plant, the aqueducts, and the discharge structure into the existing Bethany Reservoir. One of the key points here that I'd like to point out with the Bethany Reservoir alternative, it's close to the total miles of Eastern at 44.6 miles, just under. A key difference is that it has only two launch locations within the whole alignment. So the entire 44.6 miles would be excavated from two major launch facilities, each of them being a double launch. So there's TBMs driving in two directions from each of those locations. But that's a distinct difference from what we were able to develop in the conceptual designs for Central and Eastern. It does require about 3 miles of aqueduct pipeline. These are 15-foot diameter aqueduct pipelines. And the set of those, the number of pipelines varies by capacity. But those would be used to deliver that water directly up and discharged into Bethany Reservoir. Next slide, please. So now I just want to shift gears for a minute and talk about the Stakeholder Engagement Committee. We walked through the current conceptual designs for the project, but as part of getting to this point, the DCA created the Stakeholder Engagement Committee. The committee was not required or mandated, but was created by the DCA with a specific focus on providing feedback to the design team that may help reduce potential construction-related effects, with a lot of emphasis on facility siting, traffic, waterway effects, land use, and other regional effects. The committee consisted of a total of 17 committee members representing a wide array of interests and locations within the Delta. Also, two DCA board members participated as representatives leading the Stakeholder Engagement Committee. We had three ex officio members as well. Just to summarize, the members came from Sacramento, Yolo, San Joaquin, Contra Costa counties, all surrounding and part of the Delta. Tribal governments also participated. We had representation from Delta Recreation, Public Safety, local businesses, community entities, as well as the agricultural industry, historical and heritage, Fish and Wildlife, and Delta Water agencies, all represented within the stakeholder engagement commitment. So these are folks who live and work in the Delta. They do not support the project, but they were willing to participate in this body so that if there were to be a project, it would reflect some amount of local community input. The SEC has generally been focused on engineering aspects of the project, but has also been briefed at times by DWR on the progress on the environmental analyses, as well as the community benefits program. In total, we convened 19 3 to 4 hour long meetings over the last 2 years, including a total of 65 presentations that were developed by the DCA or DWR and presented to this body. Next slide, please. So we began the work with the SEC in November of 2019 by providing an introduction to the system. And then we worked our way through a detailed review of all the key project elements, such as intakes, tunnels and shafts, facilities in the South Delta, as well as the Bethany Complex. We reviewed the siting alternative studies for all of these facilities, including review of the considered factors, the scoring approach and rationale, the resulting rankings for various sites and alignments and considerations. So as the alignment started taking shape based on all of those siting studies, we then continued to review the construction footprints and logistics and traffic plans with the SEC. And then as we made adjustments to the conceptual designs, we brought those back to the SEC to show them how their input was listened to and incorporated into the conceptual designs. Next slide, please. So I'm sure you can imagine that the SEC had a lot of concerns to express about the project and about conditions in the Delta, some of which I will say were completely unrelated to the Delta Conveyance Project, but there was a lot of good input that came out through those discussions. And in listening to their concerns and input, we did make many adjustments to the conceptual designs along the way. The list that I've got here on the left side is just a short list of valuable input, beginning with a pretty significant effort there. I'll begin at the top of the list, a pretty significant effort to reduce the construction footprint and also thinking hard about or reduce the construction footprint by evaluating methods and opportunities for reclaiming agricultural land and putting it back into some sort of productive use after construction of the project. We also looked at each and every site and thought very hard about the layout, trying to minimize the overall construction footprint as well as the permanent footprint. We also shifted facilities away from natural areas, including Stone Lakes Reserve as well and the Woodbridge Ecological Reserve. We initially were considering using barging as a way of moving materials, bulk materials around the Delta and supporting the project. But based on a lot of the input that we received through the SEC, we eliminated most of that barging, mainly due to recreational boating effects. But to make up for some of that, we added a lot of potential rail connections in the conceptual design, expanded roads, the existing roads, and eliminated structures, even reconfigured the project to avoid having to rebuild or reconstruct some of the more impactful elements that would have been required. We reduced the borrow and import required to trying to reduce traffic loads on existing roads. And I mentioned the project-wide soil balance. That was a big part of that, trying to make, to the extent possible, sites balance out using material excavated on site and generated versus material needed for fill on site, trying to do our best to make all the use we can of that existing information. As I mentioned, there was a lot of discussion on the reusable tunnel material and specifically the tunnel conditioners that are typically used for, depending on the methodology, used in some of those machines. And so we dug into that and came back and presented the some of the newer products that are on the street, which are really kind of eco-friendly, biodegradable conditioners that can be used and are much more friendly to the environment as they break down. And then also we heard some specific concerns about noise impacts up at the intakes and around some of the communities up there. And so we took a deep dive into the cofferdam configuration for the intakes and were able to come up through some creative thinking, a significant reduction in pile driving impacts by about 80% through redesign of that cofferdam approach. So again, this is just a relatively short list here, but these are all the types of things that we got incorporated into the conceptual designs that really came out of that SEC process. Next slide, please. So the DCA has largely completed the conceptual design for the three alignments, although we're still iterating and refining on some of the information based on feedback from the environmental team. It was always intended that the SEC would wind down once the conceptual design phase was completed. Going forward, there really won't be engineering content for the SEC to opine on and provide feedback. I'm sorry, I'm using the shorthand SEC, but that stands for the Stakeholder Engagement Committee. And so at this point, we think that it makes sense, and we've already communicated to the SEC that the next meeting in December should be the last meeting for the SEC. Certainly, if there's a project recommended and we begin down a path of detailed design at a later date, then there would be even more engagement with local folks to refine the design plan and work through any concerns or feedback that we might be able to understand and hear more about. Now, this certainly doesn't mean that this is an end to public engagement in the near term. It's just a pivot consistent with the current stage of the project. The DCA will continue to expand our outreach. This is to try and make sure that current engineering information is available to the public. We've been holding a series of community engineering briefings with folks very local to potential project alignments and footprints, making sure that they're hearing directly from us what's included in the current conceptual design of the project. We've also been working with 20 local libraries in and around the Delta to distribute hard copies of all of our conceptual design information, as well as thumb drives with all sorts of electronic files related to the project available. We've also been continuing to update our virtual tours, which I'm sure if you haven't had a chance to explore, you might find interesting. It's a bird's eye flyover. This is available on the DCA website. we've expanded that flyover to also include now additional languages of Chinese and Spanish in addition to English, just again trying to improve accessibility to current engineering information. As you can imagine, there's been a lot of work done over many years, and we want to make sure that folks really understand what the current project consists of and what's included versus what they might be thinking from past or different efforts. So the big shift here is going to be that, and you're going to hear from Carrie in a minute, is that DWR is expecting to release the public draft of the EIR next year. And so they will be leading the outreach efforts associated with the CEQA process, and they've got a really robust plan for engagement with a lot of opportunities for public input. So just wanted to summarize how that input has been used thus far. And at this point, if we could go one more slide, April. I just want to wrap up my portion of the update. So here's our overall schedule through the duration of planning. DWR's major milestones are shown on the top there, but the DCA's activities, more to the point of my subject, are there on the bottom. You can see going forward from the dashed line, which is the current date, our focus will continue to be on the collection of subsurface information throughout and across the Delta, trying to validate our assumption used in development of the conceptual designs. We'll also be continuing with stakeholder engagement activities, as I mentioned on the previous slide, responding to requests for information from DWR or requests to adjust or consider possible solutions for adjustments within the conceptual design. And then sometime next year, we will begin providing support to DWR for various hearings or permit preparation activities. So with that, I think next slide, please, April, and I'll hand it over to Carrie to discuss DWR's update on the planning process.
Thanks, Graham. All right, we can go to the next slide, please. So sort of accompanying the schedule that Graham just presented, this is an overview of the process that we're working through on the environmental side. So right now, our main focus is working on the CEQA and NEPA processes. So CEQA is the California Environmental Quality Act, and NEPA is the National Environmental Policy Act. So for both of those, we're preparing a draft environmental impact report, or EIR, and the Corps of Engineers, as the federal lead, is preparing a draft environmental impact statement. They are going to be two separate documents. That's what the Corps is looking for. But we are trying to align the public review periods to help minimize the difficulty of reviewing two documents for the public. So that public review period will be in mid-2022, and then we will be working towards final documents and decision documents in late 2023. Concurrently, we're starting some of the work on the environmental processes. So we've started a little bit working on the biological assessment, which is what we will submit for the Endangered Species Act compliance, and the incidental take permit application, which is what we'll submit for California Endangered Species Act compliance. I will submit those in early 2022, and NIMS, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and CDFW will work on those compliance documents into 2023. We'll also start next year working on our change in point of diversion for our water rights and start some of the planning for the Delta Plan consistency and working on setup for other environmental permits as well. Next slide, please. So as Graham was talking about the conceptual design of the alternatives, we've also been working on the conceptual operations for the alternatives. And we did present some of this information during a series of technical webinars we had this summer. What we're looking at now is a sort of starting point for operations. So as we go through and analyze the potential for environmental effects, we may change different types of operations to reduce or avoid those effects, but we need a starting point to analyze, something to look at. So we would be operating our proposed North Delta diversion intakes in conjunction with the existing South Delta intakes. That's a system called dual conveyance. So we aren't planning to abandon the South Delta intakes, but rather look at the two systems working together, which provides flexibility. So we can use either the South Delta intakes that are there now or the new North Delta facilities. So we've had to make some assumptions about how the two would work together. And so what we're looking at is during the winter and spring, water would first be diverted at the South Delta in the same way that it is currently permitted. And the North Delta would be used to divert additional flows during high flow periods. And then during the summer and fall, there would be some small use of the North Delta diversion to help manage salinity in the Delta and realize potential carriage water savings. And so this system we think will hopefully maximize benefits while minimizing impacts. But again, we need to go through the impact analysis to figure that out. And then we may make some shifts to further that goal. Next slide, please. So we're working on developing criteria for the North Delta intakes, and a lot of the other criteria that would manage Delta operations would remain unchanged. So generally, we're using the existing rules. So they come from the 2020 incidental take permit for long-term operations of the State Water Project. So in that, we have Delta outflow requirements. There is also an export inflow ratio that is part of the state board's D1641. And in order to comply with that, we would account for water diverted at the North Delta as part of the export part of that calculation. It would be combined with South Delta exports. There are also Old and Middle River requirements and export limits. And so we would be a part of all of those requirements that are existing. And then we would layer on new requirements at the North Delta intakes. So if we could go to the next slide. This looks at just the key types of operational criteria that we're considering. So the first is that we have a fish screen approach and sweeping velocity criteria. So at the diversion, we will have state-of-the-art fish screens. And so we would include criteria for approach velocity, which is the velocity that water is going through the fish screens. And then sweeping velocity criteria, look at the speed that the water is going past the screens. And there are criteria from the fishery agencies for both of those to help minimize the effects on fish right near the fish screens. I will also look at bypass flow criteria. So that dictates how much water must stay in the Sacramento River and bypass the intakes. And so when river flows are lower, there would be no water diverted, and then there would be a percentage increase as the flows increase. So, you know, I think people hear that the facility could be a 6,000 cubic feet per second facility and think that the intakes would just be open and operating like that year round. But in fact, they would not. Whenever flows are low, there would be no diversion or very low diversions. And those diversions would only increase as flow in the river increases. We also have pulse protection, where we would be looking at protecting a pulse of migrating fish. And low-level pumping, which is where we've identified a diversion level that would have minimal effects on fish either in the area or downstream in the Delta. Next slide, please. And this looks at our conceptual model of fish in the intake reach, and this helps understand the criteria that we're considering. So at the top, you can see how we think fish migration works in the intake reach. So there are fish that are migrating out past the intake during much of the winter, but there aren't a lot of fish migrating except in these groups, because there are flow cues that the fish move downstream in these pulses. And so what we're trying to do is have some bypass flow criteria that protect fish all the time that may be there, but really focus on protecting those pulses when we think that there are fish there in large concentrations. And then additionally, we would always have those approach and sweeping velocity criteria present. So again, these are our initial criteria that we've been looking at. We're going to start these in our analysis and then think about effects and think about ways that we may adjust those to reduce effects, which leads to our next slide, please. So right now we are working really hard on impact analysis. So we're looking at all of the construction information and operations and maintenance and looking at an assessment of the potential environmental impacts and where we have potentially significant environmental impacts, ways to mitigate those, avoid or reduce those effects. So the construction effects are really driven by the conceptual design information that's provided by the DCA. And those include things like air quality, or traffic, or noise. And then the operational effects include things like changes to water operations, so it's water quality or fish or other operational effects that are really within waterways typically. And so those effects we're analyzing using a series of modeling tools. Next slide, please. So this slide provides an overview of the framework we're using for our modeling. And I'm not going to go through all of this in a lot of detail. I just wanted to sort of highlight that there is data that comes into the modeling system. We're using information from global climate models for temperature and precipitation changes. We're using climate change hydrology, sea level rise, and sea level rise flow salinity relationships. And all of that is feeding into CalSim3, which is a project simulation model. So CalSim2 has been historically a model that was used a lot to look at how State Water Project and Central Valley Project operations would function under different conditions. It simulates operations with different parameters. So this reflects an update to that model for CalSim3. So that then feeds a number of what we're calling downstream models. And so that includes DSM2 for delta hydrodynamics and water quality, SALMOD and a series of models for fish that look at salmon mortality and population, and C2VSIM for delta groundwater. Next slide, please. So for the modeling scenarios, we're looking at two baselines. We're looking at an existing conditions baseline and a no project alternative in 2040. And both of these would have no delta conveyance project in them. The future condition would include projected land use, urban growth, climate change, and sea level rise. So we would layer the proposed project and alternative on top of existing conditions and compare them to existing conditions. And that comparison gives us an understanding of the potential effects of the alternatives under existing conditions. We will also be looking at a comparison for the future where we would layer the proposed project and alternatives onto the no project alternative and compare it to that 2040 baseline. And that would give us an idea about whether those potential effects would change as we look into the future where climate change and sea level rise are part of the situation. So this modeling will help provide the basis for an assessment of both impacts to things like water quality and fish, as well as potential benefits to things like water supply for State Water Project users. Next slide, please. And as Graham mentioned, in 2022, we have really a robust plan for public outreach and community engagement, and it's really focused around the release of the draft EIR. Release of the draft EIR is somewhat changing the focus of how we're doing our outreach. It's really focused on bringing people into the process, making sure that they understand the material that's there, helping them understand the material that's there, and providing a way to provide formal comments. So we have sort of three main areas that we're looking at. The first is public information, where we'll provide informational resources to help the public review, understand, and react to the draft EIR. That could include things like videos, website updates, fact sheets, graphics, social media, flyers, and e-blasts. Then we have public outreach and engagement. And this is a proactive effort to inform and engage. Again, to sort of bring people into the process and try to help them understand what's there and how to review it. So it would really encourage and assist in participation. So it could include emails, phone calls, briefings, meetings, and presentations. And then the public participation and notification area is sort of the formal part of the CEQA process. So we need to make sure we're providing meaningful opportunities to access the public review documents and provide formal comments. And so that can include workshops, publicity, flyers, providing materials through libraries and translations. Next slide, please. So thank you, and I think I'm turning it back over to President Martin.
Thank you, Carrie. Thank you, Graham, for your presentations. Before we open it up to board question and discussion, April, do we have any members of the public who would like to provide a public comment on the presentation?
It doesn't. Oh, we do. Just one moment. Missy, please go ahead and begin your public comment. Let me hit star six. I'm not sure if you're on a landline. I believe you're not. You can just go ahead and unmute and begin your public comment.
Okay. Hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Okay, great. Hi, my name is Missy. Thanks for the opportunity. Say, if I'm understanding your presentation, that this project is about repairing the current infrastructure and also providing water for the, as you currently identified, 3 out of 5 Californians depend on the water from the Delta. So am I getting that correctly? Okay. Yes. So then based on that was there ever in the planning of this project to consider an alternate, an additional water source, say the Pacific Ocean, at one point or another to supplement the water coming out of the Delta that is needed for 3 to 5 Californians? Is that ever a planning consideration? That's my question.
Okay. Missy, does that complete your public comment?
Yes.
Thank you.
Very good.
Is there any further public comment? It does not appear so. Back to you, President Martin.
Before we open up to board question and comment, I'd ask Graham or Carrie if they'd like to provide a response to that one public comment. Feel free.
Sure, I can go ahead and do that. So we did hear suggestions during scoping that we should consider other types of projects like desalination or water recycling. And a couple of thoughts on that. First, the Delta Conveyance Project is part of the state's water resilience portfolio that looks at the suite of water challenges facing California and a lot of actions used that would be necessary to help address those challenges. And so Delta Conveyance is one of them, but other types of projects like conservation, recycling, and desalination are also there. The idea that Delta Conveyance isn't instead of those projects, but in addition to those projects. But the proposal was, what about doing them even more so that Delta Conveyance wouldn't be necessary? And so we did look at that. That was part of our alternative screening process. And what we identified as we did that is that doesn't really meet our objectives for undertaking this project. So the State Water Project is owned and operated by DWR. And so as the owner and operator, we would like this State Water Project to be able to continue to function into the future in the face of these challenges. So saying, well, we'll let it continue to degrade with sea level rise and climate change and have the water contractors that receive water have to find alternate supplies didn't really meet our objectives. However, it does reflect what those water agencies could do if they did not have the Delta Conveyance Project. So while we are not including it as a separate alternative, we are including consideration of those types of projects at a general level as part of our no project alternative, what could happen if the Delta Conveyance Project did not move forward.
Thank you, Carrie. We can now open it up to board questions and discussions. I see Director Planbeck has her hand up. So go ahead, Director Planbeck.
Muted.
Sorry. Okay, so towards the beginning of the discussion, there was a summary of the reasons for the project, and one was to minimize seismic risk. And I wondered if you could go in a little bit further into what seismic risk you're minimizing. And then So I, through the presentation, I did find that you're going to do 6,000 cubic feet per second in addition to the Banks pumping plant, which I was a little hazy on before. So I'm wondering, when we are already eliminating fish in the Delta, how, you know, this is just a naive question. I mean, it seems like the Delta smelt have already nearly gone extinct, and I don't understand how that's going to be protective of fish. I saw your presentation on it, but I don't see how taking more water is going to do that. And then you said you were going to comply with 1641, and I may be getting 1641 mixed up with 1645, but is that the water quality regulations? And if so, aren't you already not complying with them? Is this going to, can you, maybe I don't understand. You know, I'm a Southerner, so not watching the Delta so much as some other people are. So, and then, so I can go back through this list, but then I wanted to do them all at once. And then you said you're going to not just have both pumps on at once, the Banks and the other new one. You have this regime that you've proposed, which all sounds very logical, but I think a lot of people have been concerned that once a big tunnel gets built, it will tend to be used. And unless there's some kind of regulations that are written out or, you know, codified, that the regime that you describe, no matter how logical, won't end up being what's happened. I mean, there's incredible development pressure down here. They want more and more water. And if you don't have some kind of regulation that you're not going to just pump the heck out of those new tunnels and pumps, I don't see how that's going to happen. That's my cat that's going back and forth behind me. So she wants to know too. Okay, that was all. Thank you.
Okay, Carrie, feel free to respond. And Graham, go ahead.
Sure, I can get started on this one. So I started taking notes, but Director Flambeck, I'm not sure I hit all the points, so we can come back to things if I miss things. So starting with the purpose to related to seismic risk. So one of the issues that is of concern in the Delta is that there are several faults in or near the Delta, and the Delta is primarily peat soils, and many of the levees have been constructed over time by local agencies, and the levees may not be able to stand up to those types of earthquake actions. So the concern is that if there is a seismic event and levees do fail, that the water from the bay would rush into the Delta to fill that island, and the seawater would then move further inland, and the Delta would have much higher salinity so that it could not be used for any of the beneficial uses. So for the environment, for local supplies, for ag, for Delta diversions. So those are the concerns about seismic risk in the Delta. And I think that what the project is considering is the idea that if we could divert upstream where that would be less of an issue, that would solidify the stability of the State Water Project into the future. You had mentioned that there would be 6,000 CFS in addition to Banks, and highlighting two of the alternatives, the eastern and central alternatives, would both need to go through the Banks pumping plant. So it's still all moving through Banks. The third alternative, Bethany, would not, but it still is moving through the California Aqueduct. So I did just want to highlight that we're using a lot of the same facilities. There is the potential that we would divert more water at times, but it would be focused at times that would be wetter periods. So this would be the only times that we would be able to, with our operational criteria, increase diversions. And that would really, in many ways, be offset as we look at climate change and sea level rise by the times that we would be diverting less
water. And let me just ask you right there, are your operational mm-hmm. criteria going to be codified? That's, I mean, I perfectly understand that what you're saying is logical. I'm just not sure that it would be followed.
So they will be codified, but I don't think we're planning to have an upper limit on the amount of diversions. We're planning to have operational criteria that are protective of fish and water quality without necessarily looking at an upper limit at any one time, because this operational regime is different what we have now and is really focused on those wetter periods. But in terms of your comment about being concerned that we wouldn't follow those rules, it would be requirements that come through our permits for the Endangered Species Act and the California Endangered Species Act, as well as the change in point of diversion from the state board. So we would have to follow those rules based on our compliance with CEQA, and we would also have other agencies that would be monitoring us to make sure we're following their rules, including U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, NIMS, DFW, and the state board. So there would be a fair amount of monitoring of compliance as well. And then I think that your concern about fish in the Delta, particularly Delta smelt, I think that there is a lot of concern about the status of Delta smelt right now. And we are certainly very aware of that as we're working on our analysis. Under the Endangered Species Act and the California Endangered Species Act, we cannot take those fish. So whatever effects we have to fish, we have to fully mitigate those effects. So as we are analyzing them with our operations, if we do see effects, we will either need to alter our operations or develop alternate mitigation methods that provide that we do not have net take of those fish.
What does net take mean?
So take under the Endangered Species Act includes harming, harassing.
I didn't know what net take means.
Oh, I mean that if we have any places where it can be construed that we are sort of harming and harassing, we would need to mitigate that by improvements in other places.
Oh, okay. Okay, and the other was the water quality 1641. That was the last one.
So the state board's decision 1641 is the decision that put into place the Bay Delta Water Quality Control Plan. So we need to meet, those are requirements that govern Delta conditions. We meet them now, and we would need to continue to meet them in the future, or if they are replaced by an updated plan or alternate means of compliance, we would have to meet whatever regulation is in place.
Maybe it was 1645 and salt or something that's the problem, not the water quality. Thank you.
Thank you for your questions, Director Pine Black. Thank you for your response, Carrie. Director Armitage, you have your hand up.
Yes, thank you. So since I wasn't around in November 2020, I'm interested in knowing, Mr. Marks stated that the agency agreed to a 2.6% participation level. Is my first question related to that is that a starting point, or would it continue to go up at any point from there? And second question related to that is, how does that translate to dollars? What is the cost of that, and how long would we be contributing to that in payment? And then my second set of questions is for Ms. Buckman. Ms. Buckman mentioned a carriage water savings with the use of the North Delta intake. And so I'd like some further explanation on that and how it works. Thank you.
So Dirk, are you available to respond to Director Armitage's first question?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes.
So the 2.6% is not considered a starting point, but it was kind of our share of the project. Right now we're paying for our share of the planning cost. The overall cost of the project would be basically that same 2.6% of whatever the construction cost and the operation cost are of the project. And I'd have to get back to you on the estimate. We've done some calculations in the past, but we need to look at the current construction cost and make some assumptions about operation cost. And get back to you on that. As far as how long we would be paying those capital costs, we would be paying over the life of the revenue bonds that the department issues to construct Typically, revenue bonds have a life of 30 years. But of course, we don't have the particulars of what the department is proposing in its financing plan. That's not available at this time. Along with that, we would be paying any fixed operation costs for maintaining the tunnels. And we would pay for any energy costs associated with pumping water through the tunnels.
Does, if I could follow up on that first part of the question, does Mr. Bradner have a cost estimate for the project as a whole?
Sure, yes. So, I mean, you can imagine with the different alternatives and configurations that there could be a lot of different ways, but I can just tell you that the estimate currently for $2020 dollars is around $16
billion. And then I guess the question about carriage water. So carriage water is water that when we release water from upstream storage for diversion, we can't divert all of it within the Delta. So if we release water from Oroville and it enters the Delta, some of it can be diverted, but some of it is maintained as Delta outflow to sort of keep the Delta salinity where it is at a level that meets standards. So a certain amount of that water needs to go towards sort of pushing the water out towards the bay so that the higher salinity water stays in the bay. So during summer conditions, operating the South Delta pumps can sometimes almost pull that water in. And so if we can use them a little bit less, then that means that a little bit less water is being pulled in. And so the carriage water calculations are a little different. We wouldn't be shifting entirely. Still, most of our diversions would be at the South Delta, but it gives us a little bit of flexibility to better manage how that water is being sort of pulled into the Delta instead of pushed out of the Delta.
Thank you for the great explanations.
Right. Director Brownstein, you have your hand up.
Thank you so much. So I have a few questions that will help me understand a little bit better, and I think also members of the public that are listening in. Just some kind of general, a little bit more general questions. So I was wondering, how long are we expecting this construction to take? And I guess you answered it, the question about the total of the project's estimate, but I think that that's something that people might be interested in knowing. I also was curious about alternatives, but we had, I think Missy asked that question about desal or recycling. So we got that one out of the way. Sorry, I made a list. So I wanted to know, why do all local communities object to this project? I wanted to know why we care about the fish. And if any environmental groups have endorsed this project. That's it.
Carrie, so, and Graham, obviously you can respond as you wish.
Sounds good. So Carrie, I think if okay with you, I'll start out with construction duration. Director Brownstein, we're looking at somewhere likely around a 12-year construction period. And again, there's potential variability among different configurations and alignments and so on, but that would be the general term. And then you heard the, just to say it again, the construction estimate or the total project estimate, I should say at this point, is around $16 billion, $15.9 billion is a number that I think folks are probably familiar with. And in terms of, I think, Carrie, these might be questions for you. I'm happy to answer if you'd like. I think the next one that I wrote down was, why do local communities object to the project? I mean, I could provide some input there if you'd like.
Well, you can go ahead and start and then I can talk as well.
Okay. I guess first and foremost, from an engineering perspective, And we have spent a lot of time reviewing construction impacts. There would potentially be, if there were to be a project, a significant construction project in a section of the world that's at times pretty difficult to access with a lot of limitations in terms of existing infrastructure, existing bridges, roads. There's a lot of very poor foundations out there. I think Carrie mentioned that the peat is a very soft, poorly consolidated foundation for a lot of the existing infrastructure out there. And if you do spend any time out there, you'll note that the roads have a whole lot of variability in their conditions. They're deteriorating. They tend to deteriorate pretty rapidly. And a construction effort of this size would just have tremendous effects. And so that's what's being evaluated in the EIR, but there's really no way around that. And so we're doing all that we can to take community input at this point, understand there's still a lot that we're thinking about, but in terms of the input we've received, I think we've been able to translate that into pretty effective adjustments within the conceptual design. And I think the rest is being picked up through the environmental analysis of various impacts. I think that's what I would offer, Carrie, and you could take it from there.
I think that was a lot of what I was going to mention. I think that the couple of things that I'd like to add are that I think that one of the things that is really challenging for this effort is that the benefits of this project would largely be felt in the State Water Project service area. So the Central Valley in Southern California, Central Coast, South Bay, but the impacts, the environmental impacts, community impacts would be in the Delta. And so the communities there would endure the impacts of construction, but not have the benefits of construction. And so one of the things that we've been trying to do as we recognize that is implement a community benefits program. And so that would be a set of commitments that we would make to help the communities that would be affected over and above the regulatory requirements. So this would be in addition to mitigation that we would be doing to reduce effects. We would be looking at other efforts to try to help. So that probably will include, well, we're developing that in conjunction with the local community. So we're really trying to work with them to understand what would be useful and include that. So right now, based on the work we've done so far, we've had about 45 interviews and a series of 4 public meetings. And the types of things that we think we're looking at are a community benefits fund, where we would have a grant program to fund efforts to help preserve the Delta, the recreation, economic value, cultural, agricultural values. And then the other piece would likely be a set of implementation commitments. So economic commitments as part of construction, job training, local hiring, as well as potentially some leave behind benefits associated with some of the facilities. For example, park and rides may be left behind if people are interested in using them for local benefits. So that is one way that we're understanding some of those local concerns and trying to work on them. So I think the next question was about why do we care about the fish? And so I think that to me is a societal question, probably a bit bigger than this project. So a lot of the fish in the Delta are listed under the Endangered Species Act and California Endangered Species Act. And we as a society have determined that it's important that we preserve these species. So from my perspective, we are working to do that as part of this project, and we will continue to. So I think, I'm not sure that's a satisfying answer, but basically this is a societal determination of our priorities. And then have any environmental groups endorsed this project? No. But I will also say, I don't think anyone's endorsed this project. You know, we're not at that point in the effort. At this point, we're trying to evaluate it and understand and disclose the types of effects that we could have. So we're still in that project or in that process. But no one's endorsed the project.
Okay, because I was wondering, because I've also heard that a lot of tribes have objected to the project. So I was curious about that. And the fish, from what I understand, will affect the food chain and then leak out into the, you know, that then will disrupt our ecosystem off the coast as well. So it's not just, you know, we have this sentimental like, oh, these fish are cute and we don't want them to die. It actually can mess up our food source and many other things. I mean, it's
certainly, there are far-reaching implications, but I also don't want to say we only value them because they provide a food source to us. I think we value them for reasons beyond that. So for tribal consultation, we do have a pretty involved tribal consultation process. AB 52, a number of years ago, incorporated tribal consultation as part of CEQA. So when we started the process in January of 2022, we sent out about 120 letters to tribes asking if tribes wanted to consult on this project, either under AB 52 or under DWR's tribal engagement policy. And so we have about 15 tribes that did want to consult, and I'd say 8 to 10 of those are actively consulting. And so what we've been doing in consultation is working through an understanding of the tribal cultural resources in the Delta. And then we will also be working with them to try to characterize impacts and potential mitigation. I think that they, like many others, are concerned about the potential effects, and we're working on it.
Okay, thank you so much.
Vice President Gladbeck, you have your hand up.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. President. I have a few questions, Carrie and Graham. First of all, how deep are the tunnels? And along with that, what is the material that you'll be tunneling through? That's kind of related. Another question is, what town or community is near the intakes off of the Sacramento River? And then lastly, I know you're not into design, but as far as fish, have you looked at what the electric power generating stations have been using for probably 20 or 30 years as microstreams, which suck in a lot more water than any water project here in California? And that's been very successful in the design of the intake structures. That's it.
So Vice President Gladbach, I'll start this out. So first, how deep is the tunnel? It's approximately, the top of the tunnel is approximately 100 feet below existing ground in general, although it does slope, as does existing topography. The tunneling material that we would be excavating through is generally alluvium. So this is loose material. We don't expect to encounter bedrock at this depth. So it's various formations of alluvial sand silts, clays, maybe occasional cobbles or something like that in some of the old buried stream channels. But generally speaking, what would be referred to as alluvium, it would be mineral soil as opposed to peat and highly organic soils, which are up more shallow, but not expected down at tunnel depth. In terms of the towns near the intakes, the nearest town is the town of Hood. It's directly situated between intake numbers 3 and 5, which are intakes B and C, also referred to. But other communities nearby would be Clarksburg, Cortland, and then to a degree Walnut Grove, but that's starting to get a bit further away. And then the last one I noted, if I didn't miss any, was looking at the screens. All I can say to that is that the screen intakes are being designed with state-of-the-art facilities, taking into account all the current regulatory requirements and Carrie really reviewed all those through her operations summary in terms of protection flows and bypass flows that would be required to limit entrainment of any species and especially smelt. So, I would refer the rest of that response probably to our intakes design lead, unfortunately, but that's my summary.
I appreciate that, Graham, and thanks for that. Recognizing that tunneling is going to go through alluvium, aren't they concerned with it seizing the tunneling machines?
Seizing, so there's, it's not particularly a concern. No, these tunnel boring machines are absolutely designed through tunneling designed to tunnel through this type of material. They have there's a lot going on at the face of the tunnel boring machine that ensures that it's not going to seize or lock up. There's fluid that's introduced right at the face of the tunnel boring machine to try and help things kind of mix up and get into a state where it can pass through the conveyors that are in the face of the cutter head. So this is a very good material for tunneling through. At this point, there still is quite a bit of geotechnical subsurface data that would need to be collected along potential alignment if and when there is a project. But based on everything we know now, on a pretty decent distribution of information, it looks like we should have good tunneling conditions.
I'm surprised that it's going to take 12 years of construction. for that?
Well, there's a lot of, if you look at that total span, there is a lot of work at the beginning that you'd have to think about that could be kind of early works, logistical improvements, things like that. So that's not when the tunneling would start necessarily. It would be a few years of early works, logistical setup, and then start thinking about construction of the shafts that would be needed to then launch the tunnel boring machines. So all of that to get to the point where you are tunneling, and then on the back end, there would be commissioning of the system of all the various facilities and you know, sort of wrapping things up. There's also a pretty extensive process that would be associated with the wind down of construction and transition to
commissioning. Thanks, Graham. I appreciated your presentation and Carrie. So thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Vice President Gladbach. Director Ozahowski. Your turn.
Mr. Bradner, do we have an updated boring machines tunneling rate? Can you share that with us?
Yeah, there are estimates. It's going to vary by diameter. So, as I mentioned, there's flow options within the EIR ranging from 3,000 CFS up to 7,500 CFS. And so the actual internal diameter of the tunnel would range from 26-foot ID up to 40-foot ID. And then the external cutter head diameter would be some number of feet beyond that. I mean, for a 40-foot, it's 44-foot diameter. And so depending on the size of that machine, that will definitely influence the production rates associated with how quickly that machine can progress. So, I think the current estimates are still consistent probably with what you've heard on the order of 40 feet per day. That's a good working estimate. There could be peak excavation periods where things are moving faster than that. And that's been accounted for in the site layouts for the conceptual designs. But I think you can also expect with a construction project like this, there will be down days too. So there'll be up days and down days. So on average, we're working with something on the order of 40 feet per day.
Okay, thank you. And Mr. Bradner, Ms. Buckman, thank you for coming and sharing this information with us. Back to you, President Martin.
Thank you. Before I take Director Armitage's second question, Director Ford, go ahead with your question.
Thank you, President Martin. Carrie and Graham, thank you guys very much. It was extremely informative. And a quick question for you is, does the project description in the environmental documents and also the construction include some offsite storage for the system so that if we're able to achieve in a wet year additional flows to the State Water Project, that we have some areas to store some of the additional water? Thank you.
Thanks. So at this point, we're focused on the Delta Conveyance part of the State Water Project system. There are other planning efforts that are considering things like seismic improvements elsewhere in the system, other types of storage, but our project is really focused on Delta Conveyance.
I would offer that you heard mention of a facility called the Southern Forebay associated with the central and eastern alignment. That forebay is not big enough, is not intended to provide any sort of significant storage. It's on the order of 9,000 acre feet of storage, total storage capacity. And its purpose is really to help balance the flow that's coming in, that would potentially be coming in through the tunnel versus flow that could be introduced to the Banks Approach Channel through the existing Clifton Court forebay and existing intake structure. And so that's a balancing facility that's needed to help help make those two systems merge together and then feed Banks Pumping Plant in a predictable way. So it's not a storage facility in any major sense.
Does that answer your question, Director Ozowski? Director Atkins, go ahead with your question.
Thank you both. Excellent presentation. I look at the State Water Project and realize that it was built some years ago to serve a population of about 10 million, and it's now stretching to serve 40 million. And in the face of that, the peripheral canal was designed for 21,000 CFS, and it was dropped to 9,000 CFS, and now we're looking at 6,000 CFS. In the face of 30 million more people and probably further population growth, my concern is, if we build a system that's 6,000 CFS, is that going to serve us adequately in 50 years? And I've never heard, in my opinion, I've never heard a response to that concern that satisfies. So I'm hoping you have something that you can share that makes sense for me.
So I can take a stab. We are looking at a range of potential capacities to understand the types of benefits and impacts associated with them. But the range does extend from 3000 CFS up to 7500 CFS. We aren't looking at higher rates. Generally, we're looking at this as Mr. Marks discussed early on, this is sort of a next generation of projects that have been studied in the past. And so 9,000 CFS and it was 9,000 to 15,000 CFS that were studied as part of the Bay Delta Conservation Plan and California Water Fix. And so because this is the next iteration, the governor determined that this was a good way to go, and we are studying the project as he determined, which I think is probably not a satisfying answer for you. But I will say that we are looking at this range of capacity. So I do think that while we aren't studying much larger facilities, I think that what we're looking at will provide some information about how capacity affects benefits and impacts that you should find useful.
The governor is not a technician that gives me confidence that he has the answer. So I'm looking for technical reasons why it's been so drastically reduced. And I've never really heard a good one. So sorry, I don't mean to counter you, but I don't think the governor is that type of technician.
Let's take our next question. Director Armitage, your next round of questions.
Thank you. So I have two. The first one is kind of a follow-up from my cost question earlier. So I did some quick calculations on a very basic calculator. So if the overall cost ends up being somewhere around $15 billion. Does it sound right that 2.6% would be a $416 million contribution from our water agency for that? Okay. Are we locked into paying this? Are we fully committed to contributing this amount of money or around this amount of money?
Dirk, go ahead.
No, we are not committed at this time.
Okay.
Before the board would be committed to that. The board would have to consider the EIR and consider the contract amendment, or a contract amendment that defines those. That payment scheme, although DWR it can be argued that DWR has the authority to bill us for a Delta conveyance facility in our existing contract. But at this point in time, the contractors are working with the department on this path of a contract amendment.
Okay, thank you. And then my second, I guess really more of a comment than a question, is Director Bronstein had asked if there were any environmental groups that endorsed this. But I would take that a step further and ask, and I think I know the answer actually, whether or not any environmental groups have objected to this so far.
So, yes, I mean, I think that certainly many environmental groups have expressed concerns. I would say many people in general have expressed concerns during scoping about the potential types of effects, things that they want to see studied. But again, at this point, you know, it's not necessarily that people are sort of formally determining the, we haven't gotten so far yet to actually have been able to analyze the things that they've proposed. So we're still in that process.
Okay. And I think just for the benefit, since we have a lot of students watching, I think it's important to share that, at least from what I have read, the concerns that a lot of the environmental groups are stating is that this project will take a lot of time, obviously cost a lot of money, could potentially bring harm to the Delta ecosystem. And part of the argument is that rather than spending all this money kind of in one place, that perhaps we should consider investing, or local agencies should consider investing these huge amounts of money into local projects, things like water recycling and stormwater capture and groundwater recharge, those types of projects that could be done on a local basis. So I just wanted to put it out there so that people see the other side of the argument as well. So thank you.
Thank you, Director Armitage. I'd like to wrap this up. So Director Bernstein, go ahead with your question.
Real quick. I wanted to thank the other directors that had all those technical questions, because I am always amazed by what us human beings can do. When you're talking about how big those pipes are and how we're going to be putting them in, it's just amazing that we think of these things and we can do that. So that's really, really cool. I get geeked out of it when I see bridges. We're amazing, what we can think of. But my question is more, where is the... Since we're not having any, there's no storage facilities, or where's the water coming from? Because as you stated at the beginning, we don't expect snow to be coming down as, you know, we're not going to have the snowpacks, and we're going to have more, I guess, wet, you know, rain. So if we don't have a way to capture that in alternative places, where is it seems a lot to do for, I mean, just help me out here.
Sure. So right now the idea is that the water would be captured is storm event flow. So what we're looking at when we look into the future is that there would be flashier storms. So more water would come as rain. Those rainstorms would have flows that go up and down pretty quickly. And what we're trying to do is capture some of the water in that peak where we wouldn't have as many effects to water quality or fish or other downstream concerns. So when we capture that water, it would move south of the Delta for storage, either in San Luis Reservoir, other State Water Project reservoirs south of the Delta, potentially groundwater storage, or it would go to use during that period.
So just how are we capturing it?
At the intake. So if there's a lot of water in the river, the intakes would siphon off sort of that high flow period and capture that water.
But it's not like this isn't a very reliable system. It's a new way of thinking. Let's put it that way. It's not what we've been used to. It's a new way, and we just don't really have enough data yet to really know that it's, do we? I mean, so, I'd love, correct me, please, because I'm curious.
So I think that it isn't that different than what we're doing now. It just gives us more ability to do that. So as I mentioned, really, that's what we saw with 2018 and 2019 operations, that was a year where there was more water available at season flow. The State Water Project captured it and stored it downstream, and some of that water has been carried over and used in subsequent dry years. So we've seen this type of operation sort of on a smaller scale with existing facilities. Right now, the State Water Project does capture high period flows. So it's not just that we capture water in Lake Oroville, store it, and divert it later. We do that, but we also do capture high flow events in the Delta now. So this is sort of capitalizing on the system that we've seen so far, and keeping in mind the changes that we think are coming based on climate change. So increased drought and flood cycles and higher flows during the winter that we need to be prepared for.
Thank you so much.
Dirk, you wanted to add something?
Yeah, so I think as Kerry pointed out, our own experience in 2018, you know, a very big year on high allocation. And during that year, we stored water in our Rosedale Bank, and we entered into exchange agreements. We reduced our pumping in our own groundwater basin, effectively leaving water there, there and in those water banks and those water exchanges. And we've benefited from those actions during these past 2 years when we've been extracting water out of the banks and from our exchange programs.
Yeah, I was just going to add, this is Matt Stone, for Director Bronstein. The other context for that locally for us is we have those storage accounts that we have invested in, and we are looking at conjunctive investments or other storage beyond that to address the fact that the supply will become more variable over time. So the whole technique we're using right now to get through this very, very dry year is we're taking a chunk of water out of storage that we put away in wet years. And in the future, we would be doing more of that. So some of the alternatives that we've looked at, like the off-stream reservoir at sites or one of the different banking programs we've talked about. So definitely this tunnel project is not intended to be a straw that pulls water out in the dry years. It's a straw that you use when the glass is full to take some out and store it for when the glass is empty.
Right. We just need to remember what it is. It's a conveyance project.
Yeah, I was just wondering, because it, the cost to the benefit, you know, investing so much money.
Yeah, we've run out costs on it. It's very competitive with other alternatives. And, you know, I think our, as we've just gone through our integrated resource plan update, or urban water management plan update process, you know, we have a lot of things in the portfolio. Conservation, recycled water, our local groundwater banking projects. And this project is kind of complementary to those. It does a couple of things. We hope it helps firm up and make more resilient the portion of water that we import. You know, there's the piece of the project that addresses longer term risks of sea level rise and other impacts to accessing that water, that portion of our water supply. The other part of it that's, you know, we probably need to acknowledge in this discussion is the Delta is not the only environmentally sensitive region in the state. And I would love to be able to go out and implement 13 million gallons a day of recycled water development for this community. But the courts and the same environmental groups would say otherwise. No, you can't. You leave that water in the stream. It's beneficial here in our watershed. So that is taking us down a course of trying to carefully find that balance and how much is safe to take out. Mm-hmm. What's the appropriate way to manage it year to year? I know that we will eventually hopefully find a way to develop more recycled water. But I don't think we can say with a straight face that it would replace our table A or the portion of reliability that this project provides.
Thank you, Matt. Director Cooper.
Thank you, President Martin. I just want to say, Carrie and Graham, thank you very much for coming. It was an excellent presentation. You know, this the work that you're doing up there on behalf of all of us is so very important. This project is key to the future of California and where California's economy is going to go for the next 30, 40, 50 years. If water doesn't become reliable into Southern California, then the economy will falter. And it's doing this project in conjunction with being environmentally sensitive to what's going on in the Delta is key to this. All this project really does is keeps the reliability that we're hoping that we have right now at 60 or 70%. It helps maintain that at 60 or 70% so it doesn't go down lower. And that helps us in the future. The money, $16 billion is a lot of money, but one way to look at it is it's buying into the future. Water projects are planned out many years ahead of when all of the need is going to be there. That's just the nature of them, is they have to be. It's a heck of a lot cheaper than a high-speed rail, and we could certainly take the money from high-speed rail and easily build this project. So this is one that will benefit everybody in the state, whether they're getting state water or not. It's the new way of using water and improving reliability that takes that load off of everybody. So I thank you for the work that you're doing. And this agency has been behind it. We have voted in the past to participate. And this, along with Sites Reservoir that we're participating in, will help us down the road in the future. So thank you very much. And thanks for coming.
Thank you, Director Cooper. And I'd like to echo all the comments congratulating Carrie and Graham on an excellent presentation. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. I'm hoping this is not the last time we see you, and I know it won't be the last time we see you. As this project moves along, our board will be interested in hearing further updates, I'm sure. The public will be interested in hearing further updates. This is probably the first time some of us have heard any of this. So I appreciate the time you put in, and we look forward to the next time we see you. And with that, we will conclude the special procedure for tonight. Thank you so much, Graham and Carrie.
Thank you all.
Very good. Thank you. And with that, I suppose we already asked for public comment, didn't we, April? We did.
Yes, we
I'm
did.
Sorry.
Yes,
it seems like a long time ago. So we can move on to item 6. We're now at the point where we can look at the consent calendar, and we have 3 items on the consent calendar, and I entertain a motion for approval of the 3 items that are on the consent calendar. Unless Vice President Martinson and Director Colley want to add their comments to the previous presentation, we can listen. Is that what you have your hands up for?
No, I just hope to pull something.
Okay, very good. Okay, so go ahead, Director Colley. What item would you like to pull?
I'd like to pull 6.3, the generator project.
Okay, very good. Okay, we will pull item 6.3. I've entertained a motion for approval of the consent calendar, including items 6.1 and 6.2.
So moved, Martinson.
Motion by Vice President Martinson and second by Director Atkins. Are there any public comment, April, on this?
Here's what there is. Just one moment. And this is public comment on the consent calendar. Mr. Petzl? Go ahead, you may begin your public comment.
This is regarding resolution SCB 235, agenda item 7.1.
Mr. Petzold, we're not on that item yet. Would you like to wait for that item to come up?
Yes,
that's the appropriate time? Okay, very good. Thank you.
Yes.
Is there any further public comment? There is not. Back to you, President Martin.
Very good. We have a motion and a second for approval of the consent calendar, including item 6.1 and 6.2. We have pulled item 6.3. So with that, Madam Secretary, will you call the vote? Call the roll for the vote.
Director Bronstein, how do you vote?
I'm abstaining because I wasn't at the September 28th meeting, so I can't vote on that.
Okay. Director Cooper, how do you vote?
Yes.
Director Armitage, how do you vote?
Yes.
Director Atkins, how do you vote?
Yes.
Director Colley, how do you vote?
Yes.
Director Ford, how do you vote?
Yes.
Director Kelly, how do you vote?
Yes.
Director Ozuchowski, how do you vote?
Yes.
Director Planbeck, how do you vote?
Yes.
Vice President Gladbeck, how do you vote?
Yes.
Vice President Mortensen, how do you vote?
Yes.
President Martin, how do you vote?
Yes.
The consent calendar is approved, and that's just items 6.1 and 6.2.
Very good. Thank you. We now can move on to item 6.3. I would ask Mr. Stone or someone on his staff, are you prepared to make a very brief presentation of this item so that the board can consider it?
Yes, I believe we have someone from staff prepared. Is that going to be Courtney?
No, actually, we will have Yogonathan or Marin give the presentation. He gave it at the committee, and so I'll have him redo that presentation for you here today.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Good evening, President Martin and members of the board. This item is for Earl Smith recommend approval of a resolution for a construction contract with NOHO Constructors for the Earl Smith Filtration Plant Standby Generator Project. I'm Yogonathan Thirumaran, and I'm the project manager for this project. Next slide, please. So this is a location map. On your left, you'll see a Google map showing the Earl Smith Filtration Plant near Cascade Lake. And on the right, it's a zoomed aerial image of the Earl Smith Filtration Plant. The blue box indicates where the generator is going to be installed. Just to give you a quick background on this project, SCV Water has experienced multiple power shutoffs from Southern California Edison over the last few years. And as part of a power resiliency program, SCV Water was awarded a state grant in the order of $250,000 earlier this year. And the board approved for procurement of a standby generator on July 6th. And the next step is to do some site improvements to install the generator. Next slide, please. So the staff advertised the project on Planet Bids from August 3rd to September 14th. And also the project was advertised in the local newspaper, The Signal, on three different dates, August 5th, 7th, and 14th. The bids were electronically opened on September 14th at 2 p.m. And as you see here on this table, we received four bids from four different contractors. And there were some issues with the apparent lowest bidder, Metro Builders. And in reviewing their bid and consulting with the legal counsel, staff determined their bid to be non-responsive. The bid form in the contract documents required each bidder to provide a listing of the similar projects that they have worked on and the superintendent's resume, for which the Metro Builders mentioned a C attached and did not attach any information about similar projects and the superintendent's resume. Therefore, the bid is non-responsive. On September 16, we sent out the notice of intent to reject letter to Metro Builders, and Metro submitted a response letter the next day with the missing bid attachments and asked if the agency could reconsider their proposal. Both documents are attached to your packet tonight. Since then, we have not received any Any response or anything from Metro? In discussion with the legal counsel after the response letter was received, the staff still recommends Metro's bid to be rejected. Since the information came after the bids were open and therefore it would cause potential unfairness to the other bidders. In reviewing the second lowest bid from NOHO Constructors, their submittal meets all the requirements for the contract documents. And also the price is lower than the engineer's estimate. The NOHO's constructors is $463,000 and the engineer's estimate is, I think it's mentioned, $475,800. Next slide, please. This slide just gives the project schedule. This project was presented to the Engineering and Operations Committee on October 7th, and it's being presented today to the board. They're planning to issue the notice to proceed for this project on November 8th. Total duration allowed for construction of this project is 100 calendar days, which means the project is expected to be completed by February next year and have the generator online by March before meeting the grant deadline, which is the construction needs to be completed before end of March next year, which we would be able to comply with. Next slide, please. The project recommendation is that the Engineering and Operations Committee recommend that the Board of Directors approve the attached resolution determining Metro Builders and Engineers Group Group's construction bid as non-responsive and therefore rejecting Metro's bid and awarding a construction contract with NOHO Constructors in an amount not to exceed $463,000 for the Earlsmith Filtration Plant Standby Generator Project. This concludes my presentation, and please let me know if you have any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Martin. April, do we have any public comment on this item before we go into question, comments, and discussion?
It does not appear so.
Very good. Director Colley, you have your hand up.
Yes, I've got several questions. I'd like to ask them in a serial fashion if I could. First question, rather than just a sort of a hand-waving argument that there could have been some advantage gained by not providing the documents, have we ascertained or is there anybody that can explain to me any specific advantage that the apparent low bidder would have gained by not providing the attached documents?
So I can take that question. Director Colley, per the contract documents, all of the bidders was supposed to be supposed to produce all the documents before the bid opens, and so therefore considering accepting and reconsidering the bid from one bidder after the bids are open would be considered unfair, and consulting with the legal counsel, it was the staff determined it would be non-responsive.
Director Colley, yeah, just more specific to your question you're asking, is there a specific instance where they would have gained an advantage? And I'm not sure that we can provide that hypothetical to you, other than we consulted with our attorney and it is considered an unfair advantage. You are supposed to review all bids on the surface based on what bid is submitted. And so
I personally don't have a hypothetical how submitting this would create a different advantage, but I do know that we did consult with our legal counsel on what the best advantage, on what the best approach to this project would be.
Okay, so to be clear,
I offer one thought on that, only in the hope that it will help. If you were to award the bid to the low bidder without them having provided the experience that you have required all the other bidders to submit, then that I would suggest might be an unfair advantage.
Okay, but they didn't gain an advantage by through the timing of providing 50 pages of experience, right?
Well, the other bidders may have given another day, perhaps provided experience or consulted suppliers for updated quotes. You know, this is where you get to the slippery slope.
Okay. Well, okay. So the question is fairly specific. The presumption is that the 50 pages were apparently, all the evidence suggests that 50 pages were available to the contractor on the day that it was due, and some administrative staff may have neglected to attach them, but those 50 pages were provided promptly as soon as we notified them of the fact that it wasn't actually attached. So I don't think anybody would be able to provide any argument that would say that they actually achieved any advantage. And
well, again, if we're to evaluate the bids at the time of opening, then what we are presented is a bid with no experience attached to it.
I understand. I do understand that it was a day late. That's I'm not. So here's okay. I'll kind of get to the point of my difficulty is that we are asking our ratepayers to pay $63,000 more than they would have otherwise paid in order for us to avoid. And I'm not sure exactly what we're trying to avoid, actually, if we're trying to avoid a future lawsuit, or I'm not even sure what we're exactly avoiding. What I do know is that under the law, we can legally excuse things which are of such trivial nature. Inconsequential is what I believe the courts have called this. So an inconsequential mistake that doesn't actually give a contractor an advantage and which does not actually reasonably relate to the cost of the contract, this board has the authority under the law to waive that mistake, if you will. And if we chose to do that, we would potentially save our ratepayers $63,000. And of course, the lawyers, I'm sure, will tell me that there's a possibility that the second highest, the second yep. contractor, the second best bid could challenge us. They would file for a writ of mandate in the Superior Court, and they, you know, we would have to defend that, and it would cost us some money to defend. But what I know is that the standard, this board is granted the legal discretion to waive that mistake, and in a challenge, in a writ of mandate challenge, as long as we have substantial evidence we would win, and the contractor that would challenge it would lose. And so I think our exposure legally is very small. And I think that the potential gain of our ratepayers not paying $63,000 more for these improvements, which are going to be the same either way, is an advantage that we should provide the ratepayers of the valley. That's my issue. And so I don't hear any legal impediment to Courtney, us.
Can you comment on the risk of the grant money? Is the grant money at risk if we get this tied up in a legal dispute between the second low bidder who would submit a bid protest and we can't comply with the grant deadline for completion of the project?
Yeah, well, our grant deadline is the end of March, as Maren explained, and so we would have risk of the grant not being qualified. So we would lose that money.
And how much is that? And how much is the grant?
We have already received that grant money. It's a little odd. So I'm not positive how that would work if they would ask for the money back if we didn't meet the deadline. Normally, you aren't given the grant funding until the project is complete. So this one's a little bit different, but there is a concern. There is a deadline on the grant.
All right. So with that, I'd ask Vice President Gladbeck, you had your hand up earlier. Go ahead with your question.
Yeah. Did you ask the attorneys, can we award it to the low bidder?
We did talk to them. We talked to them about the risk, and they felt that the better option was to go with the second bidder and not the low bidder. Obviously, we can award to the low bidder. We just open ourselves to a greater risk with the second low bidder, because the first low bidder on the surface at the bid did not provide the documents required.
I understand that, but that was an error.
But to be honest, I still don't know that they actually met the requirement. We haven't evaluated it from that sense, but they submitted a list of 50 or several pages, many, many projects, but didn't actually give us projects specific, which was the request. Have they done projects of a similar nature? So that's what all the other bidders provided.
Okay. Thanks, Courtney.
Director Cooper, go ahead.
Thank you, President Martin. My comment is very similar to Jerry's and Courtney's. Let's go back. We've had this happen in the past when we were doing a lot of construction at Cass State Lake Water Agency, where we ended up having to reject the first bidder, take the second bidder. We got sued from the top bidder, and then the other direction, the same as we're doing here, and we got sued in that direction. So the potential is already always there. But in this one, in looking what they provided after the bids were open, and when they said they've made an error, they provided 50 pages of junk. It's 50 pages of projects, lists and lists of projects that go back over 20-something years. And we had specifically asked for like projects and their qualification. And they also didn't give their qualifications of their teams until after the bid was open. And some of those go back many, many years. I just don't think that they were responsive in what we were asking for. When they realized that they didn't, they just threw the kitchen sink at it and said, here, take what you got. So I certainly don't think we should be giving them the contract.
Director Colley, go ahead.
Yeah, so I'm still, I guess, little confused as to why we would spend $63,000 of our ratepayer money. The fact of the matter is that nobody has suggested that these folks are actually unqualified or that the product we would get would somehow be inferior. I've heard the staff tell us that they would still have to go through and make sure that out of those 50 pages that there are projects that reflect their ability to do this project. Okay, if it turns out that they're not capable of doing this project, my argument would be radically different, but that's not what we've been told. We've been told that there's an apparent administrative error, and they are presumably could still produce the product that we want. We do in fact have discretion if the second or the if we pick the lowest bidder and the second best bidder is unhappy with that, they're going to spend thousands of dollars on legal fees in order to get a $400,000 contract. That probably is a little bit of a strange business decision on their part. And our chances of winning in a case like this, if you look at the case law, there have been mistakes made which are administrative in nature, which are much larger than this, where bond documents are not complete and that sort of thing. So this error is really pretty trivial. And I think the courts would say that if we chose to go forward and have a finding that this is inconsequential and there was no advantage gained and no price advantage gained, that the courts would say that that our decision is supported by substantial evidence, and it certainly would be. I think our chances of losing in court would be very, very small, and the chances of gaining $63,000 for our ratepayers is very, very high. And so I'm not in support of awarding the contract to a higher bidder than we need to. So that's my preference.
Like Director Ozahowski.
Director Colley, you're making a lot of assumptions here. You know, the administrative error assumption, and then the potentially what will be the outcome of a court case. Those are two big assumptions here, and we have legal counsel here that tells us otherwise. To steer on the side of caution. Plus, there's the issue with the grant too. So, considering all of that, we should probably move on the safe side. That's it for me, President Martin.
President Martin, can I respond to that?
Please go ahead, Director Colley.
So we haven't heard legal counsel refute anything that I've suggested is the law and is true and would be the chances of losing a writ of mandate on this kind of an action. As far as losing the grant, it's a relatively easy matter to go in and ask to have your case accelerated under those kinds of situations. And I think that it would be worthwhile to do so if we were challenged. And again, I don't think the odds of being challenged are very high because the contractor is not, it wouldn't pencil for them because they wouldn't have much of a chance of winning in this kind of a case. And the lawyers would certainly tell me and tell us that there's a chance, anything can happen, but I think it's worth the risk for $63,000 to take that chance that they would decide to sue us.
Very good. Chair Cooper of the Engineering Committee, listen, I'm supportive of staff recommendation because I don't want to get tied up in a legal fight that might cause a delay in the project and cause us to expend legal funds to fight it. So Director or Chairman Cooper, would you like to make a motion on this item?
Yes, I would move consent item, 6.3?
Glad back seconds.
So we have a motion and a second. Are there any further discussion before we call for the vote? Hearing none, Madam Secretary, will you call for the vote?
Director Osipowski, how do you vote?
Yes.
Director Armitage, how do you vote?
Yes.
Director Ford, how do you vote?
Yes.
Director Cooper, how do you vote?
Yes.
Director Kelly, how do you vote?
Yes.
Director Planbeck, how do you vote?
Yes.
Director Bronstein, how do you vote?
Yes.
Director Colley, how do you vote?
No.
Director Atkins, how do you vote?
Yes.
Vice President Mortensen, how do you vote?
No.
Vice President Gladbeck, how do you vote?
Yes.
President Martin, how do you vote?
Yes.
This item passes, and that's resolution number SCB-236.
Thank you very much. We can move on to item 7, action items for approval. Given the action items that we have in front of us, my normal course is to ask the general manager if he has any opening remarks, but I think this one we can just pass.
Thank you.
I think we can pass this one directly to our presenter, which is Tom Bunn tonight. Item 7.1, approved continuation of remote meetings as described in AB 361 and make required findings. Attorney Bunn is the presenter on this.
Thank you, Mr. President, members of the board. I'll be brief. As you know, AB 361 allowed us to go forward with remote meetings, such as the one that we're having now, and referenced three conditions, one of which was statewide, that being a state declared emergency, and the other two being local, whether state or, well, it could be local, whether state or local officials were requiring or recommending, social distancing, and the other being whether there was a substantial risk of harm from meeting in person. You all adopted the resolution last time. It requires, in order to continue meeting remotely, you need to re-up that authorization every 30 days or more frequently. So we were going to have that on the consent calendar, but given that this is the first time, we decided to make that an action item. The board would be, there is still a state of emergency. The board would be required to say that they've re-examined the facts and reaffirmed the resolution, and that either there is a risk of harm by continuing to meet remotely, or that state or local officials are recommending social distancing. In this case, local officials are still recommending social distancing. Our recommendation would be, as it was before, that if you intend to go forward, you make a finding that both of those are true. So the recommendation would be that the board reaffirm the resolution, which is number SCV-235, and find that Los Angeles County officials have imposed or recommended measures to promote social distancing, and secondly, that meeting in person would present imminent risk to the health and safety of the attendees.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Bunn. I know we have one public commenter on this. April, go ahead with the public comment.
One moment. Mr. Petzold, you may begin your public comment.
Yes. I'm asking you to reject SCV-235, stop the extension, and go back to in-person meetings. The term used is imminent risk. Imminent risk has a specific meaning, which is an immediate and impending threat to a person or person posing substantial physical risk to self or others. That clearly is not the situation anymore here in Santa Clarita. We have the city council meeting in person. Various school boards are meeting in person. The schools are meeting in person. I don't believe that any of you can actually find that there is a imminent risk connected to having an in-person meeting of SCV Water. we are going to have a state of emergency that goes on for years, because that's all hooked into the federal government being able to give the state money to offset the cost of this. So the fact that there is a COVID virus in the area isn't of itself not an imminent risk. No more risky than seasonal flu, for instance. So I'm asking you to go back. Let's have meetings in person again. There's no need to continue these virtual Zoom meetings. And I ask you to reject the item 7.1 and return to in-person meetings. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Petzold. Is there any further public comment? There is not. Back to you, President Martin.
Thank you very much. I think we're all familiar with the circumstances of this recommendation from Mr. Bunn. I would entertain a motion one way or the other. Director Arzahowski, did you have a question before we, are you ready? Are you making the motion?
I have a question for our legal counsel.
Go ahead. Go ahead with your question.
Mr. Bunn, I just want clarity. I was able to read 361. So under this stipulation that meeting in person would present imminent risk to the health and safety of attendees, is that coming from the Los Angeles County officials that they recommend this in addition to social distancing? Or is this would be something that the board would determine that meeting in person would present imminent risk to the health and safety of attendees?
It's something that the board would determine.
Okay. Well, I mean,
I want to make it clear that you don't need to adopt that particular finding if you want to continue remote meetings, because there are alternatives. You could instead say that LA County officials are recommending social distancing, and that coupled with the state of emergency is enough if the board wants to go that way.
Okay. Well, I mean, I've been meeting in person on behalf of the agency and different functions. So I don't think it would be fair to me to acknowledge that particular statement. And also, you know, we are not a public health agency and we don't have any public health authority. So making that statement would not be proper. And I think we have to be honest with our constituents, with our customers, with our Santa Clarita residents, that you know, we want to maybe meet in Zoom to offer this format to people that are afraid to come indoors to our meetings, or that they want to they learn more during these Zoom meetings. So I want to hear from other directors, but at the end of it, I will motion that we approve this. This recommendation, this resolution, but we disregard that last statement. Or if it's needed to be accepted, we state that we are not a public health agency, we're not a public health authority, and we do not make any medical recommendations to the public. That's it for me for now. President Martin, back to you.
Very good. Vice President Mortensen.
Thank you, President Martin. Yeah, I don't think there's a doctor among us on this board. In fact, I don't even believe there's a nurse. So having us declare that there is an imminent risk to our health and safety and those of attendees, I think is so far outside of our domain that I cannot support voting for this if it contains our determination as nobodies that have no relevant experience to make that determination as a part of the resolution. So I support Director Ozahofsky's motion to be.
All right. Director Kelly.
I'm not sure that I really heard a motion from Director Osakowski.
I think he wanted to hear from other directors, and then he's prepared to make a motion.
Well, I'm prepared to make a motion that we continue the remote meetings based on the information supplied by professionals in their business.
Okay. All right.
I would second that motion.
If that's a motion, I need to ask Director Kelly for more specificity. Which findings are you proposing to make?
Well, it sounds to me like all three. We are having information regarding social distancing. You know, I still feel, and based on the demands of masks and shots and everything else, it sounds to me like there's a risk. And of course, you know, the governor's desire. So I think all three of them qualify.
Okay, thank you. I just wanted to clarify what your motion was.
That's fine. And we're not making any decisions ourselves. We're following the guidelines that have been presented by the professionals.
And I would like to second that motion. And okay. I would like to say that we are moving forward, trying to work on making sure the public can be accommodated at ad hoc meetings through an ad hoc committee. But I did attend that in person so that we could experiment with both online and in the room. And of course, in the room, we need to wear masks. And I realize that that's difficult to really hear what people are saying with masks on. So that's my reason, both for accommodating the public and for the public being able to understand us, that I would like to continue this Zoom meeting format at this time.
Okay, so let's hear from directors who actually had their hand up to speak.
Oh, sorry.
Director Armitage.
Thank you. Well, I would echo what Director Kelly said. We're not determining the levels of risk. We're merely following the guidelines offered by the scientific community that is following data. You know, we've said at the last meeting, look at the data and the rates in LA County and California by continuing to follow the guidelines. And I don't know about you, but I'm still wearing a mask when I go to the stores, you know, or when I'm indoors with other people. I'm still avoiding large indoor events to maintain my safety. The guidelines are for people to continue to get vaccinated and get their boosters. So I'm in support of continuing to follow these guidelines. And I don't see a problem with the motion that Director Kelly proposed. So I'm in support.
Very good. Director Cooper.
Thank you, President Martin. You know, I think what we're dealing with here is a little bit of semantics. I think we're all in favor of staying with the Zoom meetings for another month until we have to declare this again. But I think what I'm hearing from Director Orzechowski and Vice President Mortensen is that the term of determining imminent risk is something that we have to determine. It's not the state, it's not the county, it's not anybody else, that we have to determine that, and that we're not qualified to determine that there's imminent risk. However, we realize that there's risk, and we've been asked to do social distancing, and we've all been asked to continue to wear masks indoors. So what I would do is make a substitute motion that we accept Zoom meetings for the next 30 days, with the exception of taking out the statement of imminent risk.
Second, Atkins.
All right, so we do have a second substitute motion, I suppose, Director Cooper and Director Atkins, together with the motion and the second. Is there any further discussion?
Can I just ask President Martin to make sure that it's, because the last time this discussion came up, I think the reason that we all voted to leave it in was because Mr. Bunn said that we shouldn't take it out. And I don't really care if we take it out as long as it's not a problem legally.
We can ask him to repeat what he said. I believe if we make two findings, two of the three findings were on solid ground. Is that correct, Mr. Bone?
Yes, that's correct. Very and good. It wasn't I that was present at the last meeting, for what it's worth. It was Mr. Byrne.
Okay. Thank you. And thank you for your explanation this time.
All right. Director Cowley.
So I'm just a little bit concerned that if this changes next month, as far as what the health department is saying, it's going to be a little odd. I certainly think we ought to continue. I would have preferred the first motion, but I guess I'll vote for the substitute so that we ensure that we at least get the vote for the what we want to have happen actually happen. So, all right. Thank you.
Vice President Mortensen.
Thank you, President Martin. It is my recollection that if either of the two findings were made, and certainly there is no contention that Los Angeles County officials have not recommended measures to promote social distancing, that we would be on solid ground legally to continue remote meetings. So we don't need to make both of them to continue remote meetings. And I think we should leave the determinations of imminent health risks to those more qualified to make them, and should just adopt reason number one, that the Los Angeles County officials have imposed or recommended measures to promote social distancing, which would satisfy the requirement allowing us to continue remote meetings.
I think we already have a motion on the floor to that effect, and we have a second to that effect. So you're in support of that motion that we're now considering. I would ask Mr. Bunn one more question before we call for the vote. Our next board meeting would be the second meeting in November, which would be November 16th. I presume we would have to take this up again to say make the same findings to actually have this extend through the month of November. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, very good. With that understanding, are there any other questions or discussion amongst the board before we call for the vote on this substitute motion?
Does this apply to the special board meeting for the general manager's review on November, I believe I have it at November 5th, or maybe I've got that wrong on my calendar?
Yes, it does.
So that would be a video meeting.
Yes, and we're already planning on doing a virtual meeting for that.
Thank you.
This motion or this action covers the next 30 days. Is that correct, Mr. Bunn?
Yes.
And so the second meeting in November comes up with at the tail end of that 30-day period that we can take another action if we so choose.
Yes.
Very good. Okay. Any other questions before we call for the vote? Madam Secretary, please call the roll.
President Martin, I had one quick question for Mr. Bunn. Mr. Bunn, does that affect our resolution that we did adopt previously if we take out that term imminent? Just to verify that it doesn't. Okay.
It doesn't. The resolution was specifically crafted to allow an extension by motion, but it didn't say how the findings were to be made on that, as long as they complied with the statute.
Perfect. And just to let everyone know that the 30 days from today falls on, or it's actually 29 days, falls on the 16th. So we are good to put it on the November 16th meeting. So any meetings that happen between now and November 16th would be virtual.
Yes.
With this approval tonight. So I'll go ahead and call roll. Director Planbeck, how do you vote?
Yes.
Director Bronstein, how do you vote?
Yes.
Yes.
Director Armitage, how do you vote?
Yes.
Director Ford, how do you vote?
Yes.
Director Atkins, how do you vote?
Yes.
Director Osuchowski, how do you vote?
Yes.
Director Cooper, how do you vote?
Yes. Yes.
Director Colley, how do you vote?
Yes.
Director Kelly, how do you vote?
Yes.
Vice President Mortensen, how do you vote?
Yes.
Vice President Gladbeck, how do you vote?
Yes.
President Martin, how do you vote?
Yes.
Thank you. The substitute motion does pass with the removal of the word imminent for that section.
Very good. And item 7.2, unless Director Kelly objects, I would propose to pull that item as being unnecessary for tonight's meeting. We can bring it back on the 16th to fill out the month of November if the board votes opposite of continuing virtual meetings. Do you have an objection to that, Director Kelly?
I do not have an objection to that, but I did have a question. My hand was up and we voted, which is fine, but I had a question for council, if I may ask that regarding some.
Go ahead.
So council, if we come back on our November meeting, can we re-add any of the things that we have struck at this passing?
You mean, can you make both of the findings?
Yes.
Yes, you can.
Okay, so each time you vote, you can add or subtract findings.
Yes.
Thank you very much. Thank you, President Martin.
Vice President Mortensen, did you have something you wanted to add?
Yes, thank you. Based on April's summary of what just passed, I wanted to clarify that finding number 2 was stricken in its entirety from our finding, and we found finding number 1 alone. Is that correct? Was that the motion? And is that's how I understood it?
That's how I understood it too, sir.
And the full section, meeting in person would present imminent risk to the health and safety of attendees, that will be removed.
Thank you.
All right. So, Mr. Bone, do you have any problem with us pulling item 7.2 as that is not necessary for tonight's meeting?
No, I don't.
Very good. We will then pull 7.2 and move on to item 8, General Manager's Report on Activities, Projects, Programs. Mr. Stone.
Hello there. Okay. Well, I have tried to spare you from longer reports for a couple of meetings now that have run long, but tonight it'll be just a little bit long, not you know, extraordinary, but have more than one item. So just a few things to report on. I think I mentioned upcoming, we were going to have some safety tailgate meetings with our staff, and we did that last week. We had a total of 14 of these meetings over 3 days, and those of us who attended were thoroughly exercised from standing and talking that long with small groups of staff to review a number of items. And I'd say, you know, it was really good just to be able to actually see people in person, even with our, you know, productive use of technology. It's still nice to do that once in a while. And we had a chance to thank the staff for their efforts over the last 18 to 19 months here with unusual operating conditions. Also reviewed the agency's COVID-19 safety worksite plan, which is still in effect and required, and kind of constantly making little changes as the county or Cal OSHA weigh in. Discussed our preventative measures that we use around the office in terms of sanitation, other measures, and reminded people about things they could be doing as well. And talked about contact tracing when there is a case, what the contact tracing involves and the quarantine requirements. Talked a little bit about the LA County statistics over the duration of the pandemic and our own statistics here at the agency. Also talked about the upcoming, not yet released OSHA rulemaking and standard, which would address vaccination for employers of more than 100 employees. So kind of wanted to get that out and discuss it a little bit, get any feedback or concerns as well. I think that was helpful. And kind of as a fun part of the meeting, if that wasn't fun enough, we were able to deliver some of our milestone award plaques that we give to employees when they reach a 5-year increment. So we had employees ranging from 5 to 25 years of service who got awards, and for the first time in almost 2 years, got to hear applause, not through a truncated computer speaker. So that was kind of nice for their small group. So, and since it's their work groups that we were meeting in, that was I think went over well. We also reviewed our recently enacted flexible workplace policy, and kind of segueing to that, we have seen a very enthusiastic response from eligible staff for the program. And I think applications may have a few more that trickle in, but I thought I'd share some interesting statistics that I worked on during the Dodger game. I think it was the one that they won, not the ones that they lost. That was probably good. The average one-way commute distance. So there are 57 employees who have enrolled, and the average one-way commute distance for that group of employees is just under 14 miles. The median commute distance is 6 miles. And with the shortest being just over a mile, they could likely walk to work on good days. And the maximum is 47 miles one way. So I was curious about that because I kind of wanted to see what the cumulative effect of being able to work remotely 1 to 2 days a week would be. So I added all that up, put it in a spreadsheet, and it's 147,000 miles of annual commuting that is avoided so thus far based on the enrollment and the schedules that have been approved. Assuming about 24 miles to the gallon, that's average fleet economy, 61, not counting Teslas, of course, 6,100 gallons of gas not used. Found one conversion factor for what is a road mile equal in terms of greenhouse gas emissions. I'll have to have our green team vet that number, but I came up with about 59,000 kilograms of greenhouse gases reduced. And assuming a commute speed of 30 miles an hour, there's also about 4,900 hours of time saved. So what we did cover in the meeting, kind of what the bargain is, and obviously, you know, being accountable and just as you are in the office and making sure you have the tools that you need to do things. And if you need to come in and are called in or otherwise have a need to be here for an in-person assignment to be flexible to do that. And kind of the flip side too is now that you have a little piece of your office with you at home, which I think many of us have experienced, try to avoid having it take over your life, particularly if you are, you know, more of an on the schedule kind of employee and your duties don't extend into overtime and things like or salaried late night hours on assignments or at board meetings. Kind of segueing to another topic to cover. Rochelle Patterson and I had an opportunity to virtually meet with Andy Sells. And I'm trying to remember another staff member of his. They had reached out to us, which I really appreciated, to give us a heads up that our upcoming liability policy renewal was going to have a bump in the price. And I think for members of the board that have, you know, been around over the last few years when we've had a number of pipe breaks and things that have exceeded kind of their threshold for downrating your experience, it is a 3-year trailing average. So we will work our way out of that eventually again. But that has caused our premiums to bump up. And we also had a credit available from prior years where we were below our rating and below our rate category. But the net effect of that is about a $400,000 increase in our liability insurance. So I'm sure Rochelle can kind of provide a little more on that for the curiosity of the Finance and Administration Committee at an upcoming meeting. But I wanted to give you a heads up on it. It also will cause us for the first time in the last several years to exceed our overall budget that we had in our budget for insurance. We have about four or five policies that are lumped together into an insurance budget for non-health insurance, just general insurance for the agency. We took that opportunity also, since we had Andy as a captive audience, to sort of remind him that we are making progress on our PVC pipeline replacement projects, and we've spent a lot of district or agency funds. Sorry, why I say district, I've been here 5 years. Agency funds and towards implementing those. And so finally on that, I'd just like to thank Vice President Gladback for, I think, instilling in the JPIA staff this idea of remembering that their relationship with the members is not just as some kind of abstract insurance entity that sends out bills. I really, really appreciate that interactive approach that Andy had. He even walked us through an alternative rate that we might look at, but also then explain why he didn't think that was actually a better deal, and we concurred. But he was trying to look for anything that he could to soften that. So again, I think our experience modifier will, hopefully improve. The key issue there was just we had a number of greater than $100,000 claims, and that number had gone up quite a bit for a variety of reasons. One of the main drivers being the pipe breaks in that period. Finally, kind of on a more point of information and curiosity note, I got requests and emails from a number of our board members and a member of the community about an invitation that had gone out in an email with a video from Mayor Miranda asking people to come out to see a water harvesting video or event at the Main coming up, I think, November 3rd. When I saw it, I kind of knew what it was because I had met the individual that has kind of developed a passion for this idea and has been talking to people about it. And the question that came to me was, is this an SEV water project? Is it a city project? The answer is neither right now. But I'll just tell you a little bit about it. A few years ago, I had the opportunity to meet this local resident, John Pramick, who had, I think, first talked to, or had previous to me talked to Gary Martin, and Gary said I should probably go talk to him and get a gist of what his idea was. And it comes from Tempe, Arizona, where they have dammed up a portion of the Salt River to create sort of a recreational waterfront area. And he was very struck by that when he took a trip there and started thinking about, could you do that in Santa Clarita? Most people would probably have that passing thought and then move on to whatever was next. But John built a tabletop model of the river system in Santa Clarita and then superimposed on top of that the idea of some kind of water impoundment, and engaged a lot of people to get their feedback. And many of us were invited to come over one at a time and talk to him. And I certainly shared with him what I thought some of the constraints and challenges would be. And we had a long conversation about it it was back around January 2019. Anyway, I checked in with him earlier today and he said, yeah, this is kind of the evolution of that. And he wanted to kind of get it out to a wider group in the community and see what kind of reaction and what kind of interest there was to this. So I don't know that the proposal is exactly as I saw it, two and a half years ago, but that's what it is. If you receive one of those invitations, it is an in-person event at the Main. And so you'll have to weigh that in terms of your position on the resolutions and things, but you might find it interesting. And perhaps if you go properly equipped, you'd be okay. We will probably send a staff person as well. And that's it. It's kind of one of the things I really liked about that experience was just the idea of provoking thought, even if there may be some flaws with, or as we know, how hard it is to implement anything in the middle of a river. But I just thought it was interesting enough that, and I got, I think, four or five questions from members of the board. I thought I should just kind of share that with the board in a Brown Act notice meeting under the GM report, so we'd be okay. Thanks. And that's the extent of my report tonight.
You're muted, President Martin.
Okay, very good. Sorry about that. April, do we have any public comment before we start entertaining questions and discussion from the board?
We do not.
Very good. So I think the first hand I saw come up was Director Planbeck.
Well, Mr. Stone, I just was a little concerned about that presentation he was doing. Is it, were we invited by Mayor Miranda, or was this the way he presented it? And I was a little concerned about that. But also, did he tell you that he was planning on that it would be necessary to concrete the bottom of the river to hold the water in so there would be a lake? I mean, I think that might kind of do in our water recharge requirements.
People just need to go see it.
I have shared, rest assured, I have shared some of the water resource and even to the extent of my knowledge, you know, potential environmental concerns with the concept. And so by informing you about it, I'm not necessarily endorsing it. But I will say, spending an hour with Mr. Pramick is a pleasure. He is an extremely creative and kind person. So I don't think you'll find it offensive. And in fact, you know, it's an opportunity to provide feedback on the idea so that it's hopefully, you know, framed in the proper context, if it, you know, if it's framed at all. Mm-hmm. And I agree. I mean, there are some real significant challenges with something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I appreciated his ability to think out of the box. But as I tried to help him understand some of the other considerations, it was like those just were kind of out the window. So I don't know. I mean, it's sort of, well, you know, he runs an entertainment company, and I felt like this is, you know, this is the kind of entertainment you want. And
yeah, maybe we need to enlist those talents to sell recycled water.
Yeah. Well, one of the, if you enjoy piano music, that's another benefit of visiting John at his home. He's more than happy to play a little for you. So, Director Kelly.
I just wanted to make a comment. I find it very interesting. The county actually approximately 15 years ago, and I don't remember how they did it, resolution or something, but they went to the landowners from Palmdale down to the riverbed, and they told them that they were going to be plugging up the river with rubber dams to do very similar situation to what we're talking about. And they actually went through all the RV parks that were up there and told them that that was going to be their future swimming pool, and they had to take all their lakes and pools and everything out. So that, of course, it never materialized, but there was a lot of discussion about these blow up rubber dams that were going to be available. I don't know if you remember anything like that, President Martin, but it was kind of interesting. That's all. I just wanted to make the kind of a funny comment about it.
I'll get to the directors who have their hands raised, but the first time I met with John, by the way, I've known John for 20 years, and he actually did the music for my daughter's wedding in 2001. So we kind of go back a long way. But I did live a year in Tempe, Arizona, so I was familiar with the Salt River Project. I was familiar with the area he's talking about. So it was very fascinating, his entertaining. But I don't think my brain could hold all of the obstacles that I could think of that he would have to get through to build that project. So right now it's I wouldn't call it fantasy, but it's in that neighborhood right now. He's very creative. It's a very entertaining project, and anybody who's in engineering would appreciate his handmade physical model that he has in his home that he carries around with him in his car. He was explaining, I think he just did an STV 101 video with Bill Miranda and described his trip down to, I think, down in below LA somewhere. And he's driving in his car with this model, and his head cocked over to the side, and the model is actually extending over into his driver's seat. But he really loves the project, and he's a great guy to visit and talk about. So if you have time to go to the Maine, I'm sure it'll be an entertaining program nonetheless. So, but Vice President Gladbeck, go ahead. Sorry for delaying you.
Yeah. Thank you, President Martin. First of all, I want to thank Matt for your compliments on JPIA. I mean, that is one key feature that we have, is that JPIA is an organization of the members, by the members, for the members. So we really focus on member. The other question I have, Matt or Gary, where's the Maine?
It's on Newhall. In Newhall.
Yeah, it used to be called something else, right?
Is that a restaurant?
It's that little theater that's right next to the down the street from the
theater.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, theater, right next door to El Trocadero, Jerry.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Jerry, for your comments. Director Armitage.
Thank you. I just wanted to briefly share that I loved hearing the initial feedback about the workplace flexible policy, or flexible workplace policy, however it's called. And I'm very impressed with the data you crunched and shared with us. And I think Dodger fans would want you to keep crunching those numbers if that created a win. So thank you.
Thanks.
Any other questions for Mr. Stone? Thank you, Matt, for your presentation. We can now move on to item 9, committee reports, committee meeting recap report for informational purposes only. We only have one committee meeting, which is the Engineering and Operations Committee, which we basically discussed half of that meeting tonight already. So does anybody have any questions on that item or of the committee chair? Do we have any public comment, April, on item 9, I'm sorry.
We do. Just one moment.
Director Planbeck, did you have a question on
that? Not a question. I just wanted to
mention. We do have somebody on public comment.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
And we're going to get to that, Director Planbeck. We're still on this one item. So let's take public comment and then
yes. We'll
continue. Thank you. Just one moment. Missy, you may begin your public comment.
Hello.
Go ahead, yeah. You may begin your public comment.
All right. Say, and I just mean this in the best spirit, but this kind of the agenda item is talking about operations. And yet it also ties into the $63,000 that will be passed on to the taxpayers because of the bid situation and some of the lack of clarity there. Let me just offer in the most respectful way that because I've been involved in corporate construction for probably about 40 years, and the way we did it, which was proactive and would prevent these issues of misunderstanding or incomplete bids, is basically to pre-qualify every contractor. Contractors did not make it on the bid list unless they were already determined to be qualified to do that specific project. It was just part of the homework that we did as staff, whether I was at the corporate client level, whether I was at the consultant level. Pre-bid, pre-qualification protected everybody. Protected the bidders, protected the integrity of the bid process, and just made sure that when it came to awarding any contract, that we had a really clean and complete bid. So part of it can be that. Another part of the pre-qualification can be that the bidder's fill in a sheet that is submitted to them that says, you know, basically a checklist that, yes, you have provided all these things in the bid. It really expedites it. And in this case, too, it's more than expediting for staff. It really would be potentially significant savings of taxpayer monies, because I was distressed to hear that this was a problem. It happens, but there's ways to prevent it. And it's simply to be very proactive and very communicative in the pre-qualification and the pre-bid process. So I offer that to you for your consideration.
Does that complete your public comment?
Yes.
Thank you. Is there any further public comments? President Martin, there is not.
Thank you very much. We can go on to item 10, President's Report. And tonight, I have the honor of making an announcement about one of our dear board members, one of our longest term board members, who's already been given some accolades on JPIA, but now this is coming from Cal Lafco, our director, Vice President Jerry Gladbach, received the Cal Lafco Lifetime Achievement Award, which recognizes any individual who has made an extraordinary contributions to the statewide Lafco community in terms of longevity of service. Exemplary advocacy of Cal Lafco related legislation, proven leadership in approaching a particular issue or issues, and demonstrated support in developing and implementing innovative and creative ways to support the goals of LAFCOs throughout California. This is from LAFCO. It is our pleasure to announce that on October 7, 2021, Cal LAFCO conferred the Lifetime Achievement Award to our very own director, Jerry Gladbach, Vice President Gladbach, who recently served as Commissioner Chair on Los Angeles LAFCO, where he currently sits as one of the commissioners. A special note about this award is LAFCO has bestowed this honor, this award, on less than a dozen individuals in its 50-year history, and is the organization's highest honor. With that, Vice President Gladbach, please accept our heartfelt congratulations and appreciation for all that you do representing SCV Water.
Oh, thank you, President Martin. I appreciate you sharing. I usually don't share stuff with people, but I wanted to share it with Gary and let him decide what he wanted to do with it. So it was a surprise to me. So,
Well deserved.
Wonderful, Gary. Congratulations.
Well deserved.
You know, I just want to mention a little fact about LAFCOs. You know, I don't know how many of you are familiar with LAFCOs, but it's an extension of the state legislature, and it's not part of the county. They've set up a LAFCO in each county to do the legislative work for growth and overseeing all cities and special districts. So it's kind of an unknown organization.
Well, it's a wonderful honor. And again, you're a credit to SCV Water. No matter where I go, if I mention your name, people know who Jerry Gladbach is. And so we appreciate all that you've done and hope that you're around for a lot longer time. So congratulations, Jerry.
Thank you.
So I have a few more. Anybody else like to weigh in with a comment, please do so. This is a great honor for Jerry. So a lot of us know him for a long time. So Director of the Husky, you had your hand up.
Short comment. Congratulations, Vice President Gladbach. Well-deserved.
Thank you.
Director Bronstein.
Also just congratulations. That's really, really impressive. And it brings great honor. And, you know, congratulations.
Thank you.
Director Cooper, do you know this guy?
You know, Jerry works at the federal level, the state level, the county level, the local level, on just numerous things. And it's well-deserved. Congratulations, Jerry.
Thanks, Bill.
Vice President Dan Mortensen.
Jerry, congratulations. They don't call you the godfather of water in Santa Clarita Valley for nothing. Well-deserved. And thank you so much. It's such a privilege to have you on the board and have you on our team.
Thanks, Dan.
Director Atkins.
Jerry, I've considered you a mentor in the water industry for me for years and years. I've said it publicly before. I'll say it again, and I'm proud to call you a friend. Congratulations.
Director Kelly.
Yeah, I think Director Atkins used the word mentor, but when it comes to Jerry, he takes all the power and knowledge that he knows, and he passes it down to the new people who come on the board and spreads his wisdom and makes us smarter. And Jerry, thank you very much. God bless you.
Thank you.
Director Ford.
Yeah, I wanted to say well done, Jerry. And this makes you a king of planning in general, not just water, but everything that LAFCO does. So thanks for everything. Yeah. Well done.
Director Planback.
Yes. Congrats and ditto.
Thanks, Lynn.
Very good. Director Armitage.
Thank you. And I also offer my congratulations, and I appreciate learning from you, Vice President Gladbach. So thank you.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
And we all learn from each other.
Very good. Well, Vice President Mortensen said it right, the godfather of water, but I always consider Jerry the voice of God. Whenever you hear him, you can hear him in an auditorium with 1,000 people, but nobody sounds like Jerry Gladbach at the podium. And it doesn't diminish with your years. It only gets better, sir. So it's an honor to serve with you.
Yeah. Thank you, Jerry.
With that, unless there's any other comments from the board, we can move on to complete the report. There's a few items. Upcoming meetings, the Southern California Water Coalition annual meeting and dinner being held at the Long Beach Hilton on October 21, which happens to be 2 days from now, at 5:30. The AWA 29th Annual Water Symposium being held virtually on the same day, October 21. As a matter of fact, I think that's in the morning, but the State of the City being held at Canyon Country Community Center on November 4 at 3 p.m. The Aqua 2021 Fall Conference being held in Pasadena from November 30 through December 2021. The conference is being held both virtually and in person. And we also now have a new date for the SCV Chamber State of the County. For those who originally registered for this event, the new date is December 9, 2021, being held at Six Flags Magic Mountain. Doors open at 10:30, and the program starts probably at 12 o'clock. And there'll be more information to come. There's a note, no new registrations will be accepted, but there is a wait list. If you are interested in attending, let the board secretary know. And a few other announcements. The special redistricting kickoff meeting has been confirmed for October 27, 2021 at 6:30, which will be a, if the board so votes, the next, we've already voted. So this will be a virtual meeting. There will be a special board meeting to discuss the GM review on Friday, November 5th, 2021 at 1 p.m. facilitated by Mitch Rosenberg. And that likely will be, a virtual meeting. And as they both will be virtual. That concludes my report. Madam Secretary, are there any comments on the report on item 10?
There is not.
Very good. We can move on to item 11, AD-1234 reports. There was one AD-1234 report that was submitted with your packet. Does anyone have any additional AD-1234 reports tonight? Director Orzechowski, you have your hand raised.
Yes, from September 26th to September 29th, I attended the California Special District Association's Special District Leadership Academy Governance Conference for Elected and Appointed Directors Trustees. It was a 40 event, very informative, especially for a newly elected board director. A lot of content, and I'll be providing a more detailed written report at the next board meeting. That's all from me. President Martin, back to you.
Very good. And I would just add to that, Director Bronstein and Director Armitage, if you have time in the future, I would highly suggest that you look into attending one of the next sessions coming up. They come on a regular basis, so please consider that. Are there any other AB 1234 reports?
Sorry, just to add another comment. So Director Armitage, Director Bronstein, I've contacted the person in charge of all the events. They gave me a copy of all the schedules for next year. I'll make sure to include that in my report so you guys can take a look.
Thank you.
Sorry. That's all for me, Ms. Martin.
Very good. Director Armitage, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. Before I do my AB 1234, to follow up on what you just said, I did talk to Chris Palmer about that. I would have loved to have attended this conference that just happened, but I'm still not doing large in-person events. And I had mentioned that to Chris Palmer, and he said, oh, don't worry, we're going to have another one with all the great same information in the spring. And if in the meantime, they're actually going to release videos of each of the sessions that they did with the speakers that did the presentations at this past conference online for people who would prefer to do them virtually. So I just wanted to share that as well. But my AB 1234 report is on the meeting that I just attended. Oh, I didn't write down the date. I'll have to get that to you. Wait, no, I do have it. Do I? I'll look for in a second, but it was the first meeting of the new board of the California Special District Association's local chapter for Santa Clarita Valley and Antelope Valley. The two agenda items that we discussed were to, one, elect the board officers, and two, finalize the local chapter name. So the board officers ended up being Vince Dino from Palmdale Water District. Vice president is myself from SCV Water. The secretary is Gloria. Oh, Gloria's last name is, I didn't write it down. Does anybody know Gloria's last name from Palmdale Water District?
I don't.
She's the current president for Palmdale Water.
It's Disman.
Thank you. Treasurer is Kathy Martin from our SCV Water, and the at-large member is Drew, and I didn't have his last name on hand either. Drew from Quartz Hill Water District. Anybody
Drew
have
Mercy.
That? Thank you.
True.
Yeah. And then the chapter name we decided on was Special Districts Association of North LA County. And next meeting will be October 27th at 2 p.m., where we will finalize the language for the bylaws, the affiliation agreement, and the insurance waiver. And that's it. And I'll get you the date, April.
Director Armitage, was that virtual?
Yes, it was virtual.
Thank you.
Well, actually, it was combo. Some people attended in person, but you had the option to attend virtually, and I attended virtually.
Perfect.
Well, thank you. Thank you for stepping up and being part of that board and being an officer now. I think that's going to help us advance in our position in CSDA and be more active in that organization. So thank you for that, Kathy.
You're welcome.
Director Atkins.
Yes, on Thursday, October 14th, I attended the Urban Water Conservation District's water sustainability event. It was virtual. It was hybrid, but I attended virtually. It was well attended and very informative, and I appreciated being able to attend. Thank you.
Very good. Any other AB 1234s? Hearing none. Do we have any public comment on the AB 1234s, April?
We do not.
Very good. We move on to item 12, director reports. And first up is going to be our first report from Director Orzechowski, who is also chairing the Ad Hoc Board for Technology and Remote Public Participation Committee. So I would just turn it over to Director Orzechowski to go ahead and do your report on your first meeting, I guess it is.
Thank you, President Martin. So the Ad Hoc Board Technology and Remote Public Participation Committee met on October 11th from approximately 4 p.m. to 6:30 p.m. This was a hybrid event at the agency's Summit Circles training room. The directors that were present in person were myself, Director Cooper, Director Planbeck. Directors that attended virtually were Director Gladbeck and Director Armitage. From the staff, people that attended in person were Mr. Perez, Mr. Cole, and Board Secretary April Jacobs. People that attended virtually were Ms. Patterson, Mr. Stone, and Mr. Bunn. COVID-19 disclaimer, face masks were worn by all in-person attendees. Okay, so in summary, the main purpose of the meeting was to explore and test the virtual in-person setup currently capable at agency's Summit Circles training room. Similar technology is being utilized by similar sized water agencies in California. We went over the first draft of a policy considerations matrix to help aid in our decision-making process. Matrix was prepared by the general manager. We were briefed by agency's counsel on all state legislation out of Sacramento that may force the agency to adapt a permanent virtual option to the public. At the time of the meeting, no such legislation was imminent. Agency's IT staff provided an update on what other similar-sized water agencies are offering to the public in terms of virtual participation and recordings and post-meeting availability of recorded sessions. Agency's IT staff provided a thorough review of what is available at agency's facilities and what needs to be added in terms of software and hardware. And the initial implementation costs were also presented. As far as decisions made, I report that the ad hoc committee is not ready to bring any final recommendations to the board today. We will be scheduling another meeting, which is yet to be scheduled. And Mr. Bunn, is it in my purview that I can present to the board and to the public potential topics that might be presented at the next meeting?
If you wish, sure.
Okay. So we will be going over all costs associated with implementing a virtual option, that is labor, maintenance, annual services, and things of that nature. We will expand and discuss the policy decision matrix. We will elaborate on the benefit to the public, benefit to the directors, and benefit to the staff. And IT will review progress, mistakes, success, lessons learned made by similar-sized water agencies, special districts, city councils, and school boards that have decided to invest early in the virtual attendance technology. That is my report. Back to you, President Martin.
Thank you, Director Ozahowski. April, do we have, that was, by the way, that was item 12.1. Do we have any public comment before we ask for board questions?
We do not.
Very good. Are there any questions or comments or discussion amongst the board on Director Ozahowski's report? All right. Seeing none, I'll just ask the general question. Does anyone have any further director reports?
President Martin, you have two hands up. Director Bronstein.
Oh, I see. Director, I'm sorry. I went too quick. Director Bronstein, go ahead.
Thank you. I had two questions. One was, how did the hybrid work out for the people that, because some attended in person and some virtually and some were in person. So I wanted to know how that went. And then my second question was, how did it go with everybody with wearing masks as far as communication went? Did you find that you had to repeat yourself often, or, you know, certain masks work better for that kind of meeting, or just curious?
Good question, Director Bronstein. So in the training room of Summit Circles facility, everybody was able to hear each other, obviously in person, and everyone attending virtually was able to hear relatively quickly, clearly, everyone that was attending in person. Regarding PowerPoint presentations and videos, presentations were able to be seen by people attending in person and also virtually. videos, the limiting factor is the capabilities of whatever router, whatever hardware you have at home. And that's something that we cannot control. But as far as presentations and able to hear people around the room or anywhere in that vicinity of that room, no issues there.
Very good. Great. Director Atkins.
Hats off, Peter. You're quite an asset to this board. That was a terrific report, and you were in charge of a powerful committee. Nicely selected, President Martin. Thank you.
Very good.
Thank you, Director Atkins.
All right. We can, unless there's any further director reports at this time, we can move on to, we will skip over item 13 because we will not have a closed session tonight, and we'll move on to, and we will also not have item 14, which would be closed session announcements. So we move on to item 15, director.
President Martin?
Yes.
I'm sorry. It's okay. Can I say something as part of my director's report?
Sure. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, I wanted to say hello and welcome the students that are listening in tonight. I want to encourage them also to continue to join us in the future and comment at future meetings. I think I want to make sure they know that their voices are important as those of future generations who should have input and give their valuable input in some of the discussions that we're having. And I'd also want to make sure that they know that they can also attend committee meetings and encourage them to do that, because it's really the committee meetings is where a lot of these discussions happen in much greater detail. And so you can kind of gain a greater understanding of what's being talked about at the board meetings if you also listen in at the committee meetings. So I just want to make sure that those of the public who are joining us for the first time know about that. And I want to thank them for their interest in learning more about their water in their community and encourage them to reach out if they have questions. And I also want to make sure that they know that COC has a fantastic water systems technology program that I know a lot of our board members have worked hard to get out there and be a part of our community. And as someone who has taken those classes and benefited from them, they are a great, great resource for anyone who's perhaps their interest was piqued tonight from some of the discussions. So I would encourage that. And then I want to say thank you to the public relations and outreach team, because I am seeing more outreach happening regarding the programs that are available for utility assistance going out into the public. So I'm really grateful for that, and I'm happy to see that going out. So thank you to the team that's working on that. And then lastly, just congratulations to all the staff who received a milestone award that General Manager Stone mentioned earlier. So thank you.
Excellent. Thank you, Director Armitage. And thank you to all the students that have joined us tonight. I hope you benefited from participating remotely in this our meeting. So with that, we will move on to director requests for approval for event attendance. Or do we have any requests for event attendance? Seeing none, we
can move. Ms. Noltmeyer has a public comment. I'm not sure on which items she wanted to comment on, but it might be on the last one on director's reports. Did you want to take that?
Well, I'd like her to be specific about what she's commenting on when she comes on. That's all.
Okay. Just one moment. Ms. Noltmeyer, go ahead and hit *6. You may begin your public comment. Would you state what you're making your public comment on?
Cam Noltemeyer, yes, I would like to have an explanation as to why you're not having the closed session on item 13.
Does that complete your public comment, Ms. Noltemeyer?
Yes, I would just I think the public deserves an explanation as to why you listed and then you canceled it.
Thank you, Ms. Noltemeyer.
Is that the end of your public comment, Ms. Noltemeyer?
Yes, it is.
Thank you.
All right. Mr. Devine, can you provide a brief explanation to that?
Basically, there's no closed session because there was nothing to report.
Very good. Thank you. Are there any other public comments, April?
There is not.
Very good. Now, we've already covered item 15. Item 16, director requests for future agenda items. And please be familiar again, once again, with what an informational item is, something that you could like further information on as a director that can be requested and received from staff, and if applicable, sent to the full board. Future agenda items are something that the whole board should receive information on or would benefit from both public and board at a regular meeting. So with that, are there any requests for future agenda items? And I see Director Kelly, you have your hand up.
Yes, I'm not sure if it should have gone under director reports, but there was a request for a future agenda item to review the board policy regarding attending meetings. And I was wondering if there's anything moving forward on that.
We've noted your request, and it will be taken up as time permits. Yes.
Yeah, it wasn't my request. It was Director Colley's request.
Okay, I understand. Yes, that's fine. We haven't discussed it yet. No.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Director of the hospital.
All right. On the October 13th Water Resource and Watershed Committee meeting, there were some lively discussions regarding mitigation, option impacts, and stress tests. And I was wondering if we could receive a similar or more thorough report from that team regarding the water supply portfolio stress test, mitigation option impacts for 2022 to 2023, and the current status of those options at the next committee meeting. I'm sorry, at the next board meeting. My apologies.
You have all that, April?
Yeah, I think I might note that concurrent with that discussion, and Director Ford can check my memory to make sure I'm not misremembering, but I think there was a recommendation that's coming to the board out of that committee, and we could potentially make that presentation in conjunction with presenting that item. But I'll look to Director Ford for his sensibility on it.
Very good.
Yes, that would be my recollection too. And I think Matt has a good solution. Staff could do that at the time. Full board considers. Excuse me.
Very good.
Excellent. Director Collins. Thank you,
Matt. President Martin, I have one more item.
Okay, go ahead.
Was wondering if the agency, and I believe this might have been presented before, but I was wondering if the agency can provide us a plan with regards to Assembly Bill 1346, especially facilities and operations, how we plan to, depending on what the CARB does, transition from fossil fuel small engines to some other alternatives, or whether we can get an exception from CARB for our facilities. That's AB 1346, titled Air Pollution Small Off-Road Engines, and I believe was signed by the governor on October 9th.
I think that's been noted. And
okay, thank you.
All right, very good. Director Conley.
So I'm a little bit confused, as is apparently Director Kelly. So my request recently was to have a board discussion of director remote attendance, which is a separate issue from what the ad hoc committee that we heard a report tonight is considering. And I think I heard the response is that we are still considering it, and I'm not sure who we is.
Well, okay. We haven't agendized it yet. Let's put it that way. I understand what your request was, Director Kelly. It was basically the attachment that went along with Director Kelly's request for remote attendance. That portion of the director's handbook, which contains director's policies. Am I correct?
Correct.
Yes. That's specifically the item you want to have reconsidered.
Right. And I just want to, I would like that to be done in the short term. And if it's something that I would hope that it's not something that the board officers feel that they can veto. And if it is, I'd like to know that in advance.
No, there's no intention to do that, Director Powell.
Okay. All right. I just hope it can be done in the near term. Thanks.
All right. Thank you very much. Are there any other requests for future agenda items? Well, we are at the, unless I have to ask for a public comment, April.
We should, but there is none.
Okay, very good. So we are right at agenda item 17, which is adjournment. I want to thank the board, the staff, and all members of the public, especially including all the students that sat in on our meeting tonight. And I wish you all a good evening, and we'll see you next time. And once again, congratulations to Vice President Gladbeck.
Yes.
Very good. We'll see you next time. Thank you.
Good evening, all.
Good night.
Good night. Good night.